We've been through now about 26 hours, and I've been able to keep a picture of what I said for 26 hours. And I haven't used any notes, but when I get home at night, I begin to feel I've hurried through something too much, and I left something out. So I may get up during the night and write down two or three things I thought of in the subject. Because at first I started with a very comprehensive statement and left out details, but now I'm getting in where I'm getting more details, and I'm not going to have another run through for more details. So that there are a few things I'm going to mention that are complementary to what we talked about the last time. Number one is the tensegrity, and we were dealing with the octahedron was made out of three struts, and we found that there was a positive and a negative rotation, three struts of the octahedron, any one of them could make the octahedron. Then we brought those together. I could make this one a red, and a red. This would be a blue, and a blue. You see three that are really nearest you, turbine towards you, and I've got three towards me here. And either one of those will act as a tensegrity by itself. So we bring together two octahedra, and they give us then the 12 vertexes of the icosahedron in the triangulated patterning of the icosahedron. I'm talking about this now because, as I pointed out to you a number of times, octahedron seems to have a double value. When we remember when I used it in the, it occurs in the jitterbug phrase from the completely open here. First time the octahedron appears, it's already double. The two octahedra congruent, one with the other. And I showed you in the great circle foldings that I could not make an octahedron out of just three great circles, of which the octahedron seems to consist. It took me two sets of great circles had to be folded to give me the octahedron. So I found that the octahedron is always doubled up, and there is then this double value of the octahedron, positive and negative, either one of which apparently, you know, I can have three holding up by themselves, the other three can hold up by themselves, yet they come together non-redundantly in the icosahedron because they are opposite twists, so they're really opposing torque. To me, however, it is amazing how often the octahedron shows up, so she seems to have a volume of four where we find she really is on the hierarchy. Finally, topologically analyzed out, the octahedron is the number two. Tetrahedron is the number one. Octahedron is the number two. And cube is number three. The octahedron is this lower order. But she will always appear to you as double. And you get her in the double form. And this is what you want to keep reminding you. Something very interesting about that, because then we have the three possible structural systems of the universe, tetrahedron, octahedron, icosahedron, and the limit case of this, the smallest, and the least volume and the most quanta, the tetrahedron, and icosahedron, the most volume and the least quanta of structure, but they are really singled out, and the octahedron in the middle of the two is sort of double, having them both in it. Also, we have one or two of you have had crystallography. We get into Iceland spa, I remember, get a number of times in crystallography, we get double images, these parallel images occurring. Very much as you see these parallel images appearing here. And I also, as we finished last night, after we'd shut down the actual show, I said to people leaving the room that we are really coming to, quite clearly, to an extraordinary, greatest revolution of humanity in the history of man on our planet. I said it could be of two kinds, or it were, if power remained really in the saddle, and it became then a power struggle of the arms, a bloody one, then it would really be all over for everybody. If, on the other hand, it is of the mind and a design revolution, where the human mind really uses principles and does begin to participate in the efficiencies we find are operative. We reviewed one of those yesterday. We really went into a design revolution. We could then take care of all humanity. This is the bloody one, and all humanity will come out very well. And so I feel then the experience we're having here in this room together, I'm sure that everybody in this room is born in fairly, we're not all in the same town anymore kind of idea, even though you're young. We're from all over the place, and we're part of a new world man, and we're all you're fairly well up in everything I've said to you. As far as the general information goes, you've been confronted with tetrahedron, and anything I've brought before you, you've had brought before you, but an educational system that tended to analyze the experience of what has been brought before us, other than the way I've been doing it with you. I'm giving you a new kind of a sorting out, because I was looking for nature's own coordinate system. And I'm sure she did have such a rational one, and I'm quite confident we have found it. And you're continually going to find it helping humanity to sort things out. And we're at this moment where whether we go arms and the power structure revolution or the mind and the design science revolution is absolutely touch and go, but that's why I feel it's terribly important that it has happened. You can really make it down to it. Well, many did a whole lot of work. It is a very interesting matter that the Bell system, for instance, would have a radio studio like this available for research and development of various kinds, of the very highest order equipment, and very extraordinarily high order competence of its management, interested in carrying on such a program as this. There have been a great many people expressed desire to have this program developed somewhere where we make some kind of a video recording, but it all has happened, it's all come into place. It's come into place at a time of the really we're approaching, and it is a silent kind of a crisis, because we're in a era of humanity, which things that I pointed out to you earlier, reality of humanity up to the 19th century was everything we could see, smell, touch, and hear. And the reality of now is in that electromagnetic spectrum where 99.9% of everything that is reality that we're dealing in is invisible and not directly sensible by man's senses. So that what's going on in the way of the revolution is really on, but it is a very silent affair, because this is an accounting affair. It is a thinking affair. It's that people sorting things out in their own thoughts everywhere. Not just taking yesterday as you're approaching war, people not to do any thinking. You had your propaganda and you got everybody flipping up the flags and then the drums and so forth, and we're going to go out marching to save our side. And it's not that kind of side anymore. So that now everybody, as I said, is in on the thinking. It's the first time in the history of man where all of humanity is liberate, the first time in history all of humanity is aware of all the rest of humanity, very deeply aware. And so the revolution is on, but all of humanity is really thinking and sort of waiting for something to happen. All we know is that the humanity did then either was forced to accept various political leaders, or they in democracy began to elect political leaders. They began to elect a big father to do things for them, instead of leaving it to him. We've gotten to the point where we discovered that just to get elected in an enormous democracy such as America, that the monies were involved, and they get into that silent, invisible television program and so forth, enormous amounts of sum. The minute money came in, the whole thing became incredibly corrupt. It is inherently corruptible. So that we now have got to the point where humanity in general, certainly in the Western world, where there's any democracy, is not taking, having too much confidence, like almost no confidence in political leaders doing things. So we really have going on a really pathetic little show of perfectly sincere human beings who've been historically and traditionally in great power, they didn't have any power at all. Nothing they're going to talk about is of any magnitude of adequacy in relation to what's really going on. I did get into this big picture for you yesterday, so you will realize that, of course, and there is the complexity of playing a game called money, so you'd be able to exchange life support efforts. But you're putting in the peas and somebody else is putting in the shoes. You want some way to exchange it. Then it got into the monetary by itself, and then it got into merchants of the money as a medium, and got into playing enormous games with that interest, which I pointed out to you yesterday when you got to where banks are sanctioned to have something called prime rate. All the banks go up to usurious rates, utterly usurious, historically phenomenally usurious rates, where in 10 years, we're at 10% interest, where the bank institution, where people have deposited their money, and the bank is taking the people's money and loaning it out to people, and the bank is making 10% on their money. It only takes 10 years for them to actually take over the credit for the people's money. You're on from the money representing life support effort of human beings to money representing simply something that's manipulated by a game called money. So we have just in its own right, it automatically got into a world exchanging affair, got into a world war, because it was in the metals from everywhere, the technology from everywhere, the knowledge from everywhere around the world suddenly was involved. And with that then, we had that the money game, finding it very auspicious to escape all laws of all countries to become becoming supranational, and they don't need any passports. The ideologies don't need passports. They move around anywhere, and the great corporations don't need passports. No, they become absolutely utter national. The accountings between the different countries, they have their own offices there. They don't have to go through any states or anything. And just the people have been left national and have to have passports and conscriptable and so forth. People have been locked into a pattern of yesterday, and for the big corporation and big ideology, and they have to go supranational. So just here are we little people sitting around thinking around the world under great governance of people who big powers that have been assigned and arrived at legally through history as appropriate. Suddenly, these things are not appropriate. And I just want to also point out the great revolutions of history have always, up to now, been waged over the accounting I gave you of the big man coming along saying, "This is my land." And everybody say, "No." And the biggest man simply wins. That's his land. So the power structure could simply have the land. And we have then the revolution for thousands and thousands of years of humanity realizing that the big man owns an enormous amount, and he isn't really doing anything but fighting once in a while. He's just a man of arms. And all these people in the peacetime have to keep supporting him in a big way. So you get very easy with 99% of humanity in poverty, because up to the 20th century, less than 1% of humanity was in on the wealth at all, or any security of life. 99% had been in poverty all that time, so the 99% would always be excitable into revolution to try to overcome what seemed to be absolutely unfair conditions. So they would not like to take over the land. So all the revolutions have always been about the land and the ownership of the land. As I pointed out to you yesterday, incidentally, on all the books of accounting of our wealth, everything comes back then to what's called real wealth, or real estate. The only real wealth was real estate, was the land. And whoever could get a hold of that land, if it had lucky enough to have gold on it, fine, and lucky enough to have oil on it, but the thing is on the land. And so we find on the books there's nothing but the physical. and there had to be some chattel mortgage, there had to be some physical, some goods, either land or something very extra had been taken out of the land and priced as physical, and having to wait that airplane, so many pounds of very, very valuable materials. But the phenomenon know-how, the metaphysical, was not on the books. To some extent, it was there when patents were taken by the corporation, they could seemingly keep the other fellow out. There was some know-how advantage, but very, very small, extraordinarily small. And on the books of account, they're not allowed, they write off that patent right away. It's just good luck that you're making money out of it, but it's not on the books. You cannot put metaphysics on this. So I find that what is going on in the big money, it was really very interesting right here at the University of Pennsylvania this last spring. David Rockefeller came to speak at the Wharton School of Finance. And I went over to hear him speak because he's a friend of mine, and he was late coming, so they asked me to say something in advance. They knew he had to wait half an hour. He missed his train or his plane, whatever it was, getting him, so they asked me to say something in the interim, and I did. Then David arrived, and we both went to the dinner that followed his talk. And the students were tremendously interested in his reports on both China and Russia, where he had pointed out that he did have, that is, Chase Nasher back at number one Karl Marx place in Moscow, and he was at the very center of Peking, and that the student said, "What is it? What are you going to do for the Chinese government? What you're representing, import, exporting? What are you going to import, export?" And David's answer was know-how. Now, I've been in Japan a very great deal in the decades since World War II, and I watched the great companies and the financiers of Japan. Extraordinarily well organized people, and they were very visible and clear to me where they operate, and they were buying know-how in very big chunks from American corporations. They got going very fast in one business after another, simply literally daring to spend money to buy know-how. This, I think, is possibly the first time in history where there was really became a big commodity, and from this point on, it has been just exactly that. So the game, the military game, was a know-how game, and so the Russians would have their officers go in, and the United States would have theirs go into the puppetry wars and train the people. The know-how was always was a trick. So we find the big business suddenly beginning as dealing really in know-how, which is a metaphysical. And I said to you yesterday, very fascinatingly, the game of money, monopoly, trying to escape, and always trying to escape, is always trying to find loopholes and laws, and if you can loophole the transcendental, all the laws by being supernatural, of course it goes there. Just add to it. That's where the game goes. And so it all then got inadvertently into really just one pocket. And suddenly those who had been the monarchs of the oil lands, who had been very easily flatterable, and the people making enormous money made fantastic amounts of them, so that they just rolled around luxuriated and felt no pain whatsoever. But suddenly, with all the political agitation between the Russian and the United States, who's going to have the oil? Suddenly, the heads of state began to realize they really were heads of state, and it was the oil. And so it became part of the grand strategy of one side or the other to get the monarchs then to take over, so that the heads of the oil-rich states took over the states, and suddenly said, "This oil belongs to us." We have them. They did also realize that the incredible amount of know-how the oil company operated, so that there had to be all kinds of deals that went on in there. We have then suddenly. The whole world on what I call a petro-pap, again, so everybody's on pipelines, and you just turn on the valve and this thing works. Seemed to be by far, it was the laziest way and easiest way to get on, and so the whole world hooked up that way. And suddenly, here is the flow stopping, and we have these people who then found themselves to be the monarchs, really, of incredible wealth, claiming they were, and taking over. And the, I say, the money got into a huddle of an international cartel, what I'll just call Honey Money Boys. And so the Honey Money Boys suddenly found that their corporations needed this oil very, very badly. They couldn't get on, the industry couldn't get on without them. And suddenly the monarchs simply said, we're going to put the place up like that. And this overnight they took over the money. So suddenly we have an extraordinary condition where the sellers of the vital metabolic supply of humanity also have all the money to buy it. So that nobody has anything to buy with. Absolutely nothing on the books. The world's books are absolutely empty. So we come to a game where this money doesn't work anymore. The fascinating thing is that this has really petered itself completely out. And all everybody's trying to think, all the know-how boys and banks are trying, how to get this stuff out to get the world using again. We're now really socializing the world. How to keep a game of capitalism and private enterprise and get this thing working. Yeah. It's very easy to get the corporations socialized, but for these corporations to unsocialize and keep things going, it doesn't work very well for private enterprise. So the great silence that's going on is that nobody can find any way of making this thing work anymore and not do it on physical wealth basis. So that there is a thorough intuitive awareness that the whatever wealth and capability does come, it's going to come from the know-how, from the metaphysical. The physicals are going to be going off the books. And as I said to you yesterday, if you begin getting a world pattern instead of just a local pattern, then you can't take it with you in the next world, and you can't take it with you around the world, so it becomes really onerous. In my own personal experience, this is very typical. I own successively 45 automobiles from the time of my first owning of a car just before World War I. And then I gradually found myself going bigger and bigger patterns. And it's really amazing how just your everyday life, the range of sweep out. These are some great important figures for you. Up to World War I, human beings do average about 1,500 miles per capita per annum with pedometers show. This is average life. You're to and froing 1,500 miles a year. At the time of World War I, the world and the U.S. were on a basis of 1,500 miles per capita per annum by foot and about 400 miles per capita per annum in the United States by some vehicle other than your own feet. In other words, you were dominantly, threefold dominantly, a vehicle to get around on your own legs. And the mechanization and motorization of World War I, the word of World War I was mobilization. And the mobilization of World War I introduced so much mobility into humanity that after World War I, suddenly those automobiles going, and man went up to, the walking distance was 1,100 miles, 1,100 miles per annum, and to 400 on by vehicles that we entered. But right after World War I, by 1918, so much motor equipment got going that man suddenly, in the United States, we were going 1,500 miles per annum by vehicles and only 1,100 miles on feet. He still keeps on walking exactly the same distance, whether he sits in a chair in his porch or he sits in a chair in his car and he gets out and goes into the kitchen or he gets out and goes into the store. He uses his legs just about the same amount. So I found that from there on, within a very few years in the 20s, we got up where the average housewife was making 10,000 miles a year because she was driving to all the places to do her shopping. This is going up and up and up. And I found operating in my life where I was then beginning to sweep out 30,000 miles and then I'm going to be 50,000 and now it's going to do well over 100,000 a year. And so that I didn't know this was coming. Nobody knew it was coming. This was the synergetic interaction of all these effects of evolutionary advance of the little man himself. So finally I got to where after 1958, I again found myself leaving my cars literally at airports and not having a chance to go back to them. I was renting paying space, so I finally had to get some agent to go and take it away and sell it for me. So now I rent my cars wherever I go to, and at first I, having owned 45 cars, I went through the smell of your own car and the knowing that all the things that I fixed on it and so forth. When you did do worthy mechanic, and you really did have a better car than the other guy, because you really know how to fix your car, and he didn't. That has some meaning. But I began to realize that the big motor business was operating in a way really deleterious to our interests. I'm going to be able to give you a little insight into this because I did get into producing 3 motor vehicles, and they looked so attractive to the big automobile companies that the big automobile companies all thought about taking them on to produce them. So I had a great deal of contact with those automobile companies. The most important relationships were with Chrysler. There was the old Packard outfit, and there was a Wall Street group of Hayden Stone. Hayden Stone had owned Curtiss Wright Aeronautical, and they also owned the Studebaker automobiles at that time, the old Pierce Arrow. And the Hayden Stone group wanted to take on the Dymaxion car and make it the Curtiss Wright Dymaxion. So it was, they said the airplane world was stealing from the automobile world, and they thought they might as well have the automobile world steal from the airplane, so they're going to use the advanced know-how of the aeronautical world, produce the Curtiss Wright Dymaxion, and they were going to then make it the lead car for the Studebaker family, and would produce it, the Curtiss Wright Dymaxion the Pierce Arrow factory in Buffalo, New York, a beautiful factory. In the earliest days, Pierce Arrow, Packard, Ford, Cadillac, they produced all the parts of the car in their own factory. And gradually, World War I found a letting out of subcontracts to produce parts in a very big way. So that gradually automobile companies went into more and more of assembly of parts, and the actual fact is today that at the time of the great crash in the United States did socialize the big corporations. They then nominated certain businesses, I said, U.S. Steel, there was some prime contractors who they were going to keep alive, always be able to carry on their warfare, to get their weaponry to protect the country. So these prime contractors, they were going to always be kept alive. Now the United States then, at the New Deal time, though it made Ford Motor Company a prime contractor and General Motors a prime contractor, the criteria of being a prime contractor in the automobile business was that the automobile company had to make its own cylinder blocks, had to make its own crankshaft, and its own camshaft. That's all they had to do to be a prime contractor. And they all still do that in order to remain prime contractor, but actually all the other parts are produced elsewhere by parts manufacturers on enormous competitive bidding to the automobile companies and working in thousands of the cent differentials of their pricing. So that this Pierce Arrow factory being suddenly available, because it had been one of the companies that made everything on the old roof, didn't work anymore, and those kind of companies began to go out. Ford and Chrysler also was very deeply interested in the car. The Hayden Stone deal to produce the Dymaxion car, Curtiss Wright Dymaxion, fell through when the New Deal came in, because Curtiss Wright, in producing its airplanes, felt that it also had to have airports to fly them out of, that nobody would think of buying an airplane without an airport, therefore they had to produce some airports. So the Curtiss Wright Company really produce and owned all the well-known little airports around. They were pretty small airports, the kind of planes they had, but they were the airport owners. And it was under an agreement that the New Deal was going to buy their airports. And they were going to take the money that came from the New Deal for the airports, and they were going to put it into this Curtis Wright, that Maxim car in Buffalo. Well, something happened between the Wall Street firm and the New Dealers that didn't work, so they canceled this, so they never went through that deal. But Walter Chrysler became deeply interested in the car. He thought about producing it. And he came out the year after I produced my first Dymaxion, he came out with his Airflow. And he wanted to look at my Dymaxion. He said, and incidentally, there was a New York automobile show. That the automobile show was of very great importance in those years. And the New York automobile show of 1934, still the old Grand Central Palace on Lexington Avenue, the Chrysler Company, and getting enormous preparation to confront the public with Airflow, the word Airflow coming suddenly in, streamlining. They took the main position at the show. It was, just remember, there's still very depth of depression. 34, you're just 2 years out of the New Deal presidency, just cast him in, even though he's elected in 32, 33, so 1 year out of the depth of the depression. And so not many people had much money to take on space. The Chrysler Company had taken this very prominent space. But the automobile show couldn't sell much space to others, so they had given me free and asked me to bring in my Dymaxion car as a feature for the show. But I wasn't paying anything. So the Chrysler Company said they would not pay for this very prominent front position at the show unless they threw my car out. The police commissioner of New York was very well impressed with my... He was, General Ryan had been there. Head of the New York division during World War One, and General Ryan liked my car very much, so he invited me to park my car in front of the Grand Central Station on the Palace on Lexington Avenue. So it really did steal the show, and Walter Chrysler asked me to bring it down to his place in Long Island. He wanted to look it over, and he said, "You have produced the car I wanted to. By the time my engineers, my sales department, my bankers, everybody in this enormous corporation got through things, it wasn't anything that I really liked at all. It wasn't what I thought I was going to get. It's been modified so many times." And he said, "You produce the exact car I want to produce." And he said, "In our big corporation, we have checks and balances so that a nut inventor can't be a good persuader and get the corporation to really sink itself in deeply in something that's not going to work." But he said, "You really have had the right mechanic experience." Walter Chrysler himself was a mechanic, and he very quickly found out I too was a mechanic. And he said, "You've had the right experience and the receptivity to really produce the car that needed to be produced. And you had the capability to produce it." So he used to ask me to take out his various members of the board of directors to really see what a good car should have been, what they had been talking about. Now, Walter Chrysler said, "Let us make a comparison, since you have produced what I did want to produce, and you've done it as a little individual, and I produced mine as an enormous corporation with all the checks and balances we have." He said, "Let's look into what it cost you to produce your prototypes." I built three of them. And he looked into what it cost to produce his prototypes. And we found that in the corporation, it took three times as much time and four times as much money to produce our prototypes. And when I came out with a faultless one, as far as he's concerned, and he came out with a compromise to it. So that he was really deeply impressed with what the little individual can do. When I talk to you about trying to find out what individuals can do, the corporations and great states can't do, it's the whole matter of that bureaucracy and the checks and balances are very, very important. Anyway, This gave me great intimacy with the automobile world. Now, why the automobile companies did not get into producing my car, and I'll show you, Hudson, all of them looked it over. Walter Chrysler finally turned up why they did not. Very, very simple. At that time, for every new car sold, five old cars had to be sold. After the rate of the getting the man who had a rather poor car, you had to take in his car, and you had to sell it, of course. And so that they found that the following. In the automobile mass production of cars, the automobile producer can't own all the cars he's producing. Get up to something like a Chrysler company at a Dodge factory, say 5,000 cars in one assembly plant. I mean, many assembly, but one in just one plant turning out 5,000 a day, and there was say something over $1,000. So you got a very very you got 1,000 times 5,000, and so that you got that's $50 million. It's a very yes, about $50 million. The company can't own its own product. There's not enough capital possibly to do it. So what the happiness the automobile inventors got going, Henry Ford and others, the opposite who that people wanted their cars. There was a great profit for a distributor of a car, and it was very worthwhile being a dealer. So the dealers, there's something called distributor, which is a state area, and the local dealer within it. So the distributor has secondary dealers. The distributorship of the automobiles had been a very profitable matter, so much so that Henry Ford and others were able to write in the contract that if you have my distributorship, you have to guarantee to take so many cars a year. So and you're going to have to then, in the contract, agree that you're going to have to let me know weekly what cars, exactly what kind of car you want. Your quota for this week, we say, is going to be 300. How many, what are those going to be? Open to touring cars, runabouts, what are they, what color, and so forth. So the automobile distributor has to give a schedule, as so many station wagons and such a date is agreed on. The distributor must be at the end of the production line. His representatives must be there with papers, banking papers, to pay for the car as it comes off. And he goes through a testing and drives it away. Which I've been struck today, what the way he's going to ship. This is the only way then that the automobile mass production could occur. Then this meant that the local dealer, rather distributor, got his contract because he was a well-known businessman and a businessman who apparently, when he undertook to do something, could bring it off so that he risked the money and would make a profit, and everybody came out all right. So the distributor himself could not possibly put up the money to buy all these cars, so he went to the local bank. And the local bank knew him as a businessman who didn't bite off all he could chew, so he would finance him. So it meant then that the local banks didn't own the money, it was the people's deposits. So what happened was that the people's deposits were, you and I didn't know that our deposits are funding Detroit to produce cars. And our deposits are literally buying those cars, and they're held temporarily then in the paperwork by the bank, and they go on to dump it as quick as they can on some customer. But and the very high equity advantages of the bank has done such percentage the bank can't really lose. You're not really losing money because his prevalent capabilities and so forth are very, really very high and very almost unjust terms. Anyway, the banks then, Walter Chrysler found then, the banks own the automobiles. Then, furthermore, the salesman in order to be able to sell that car had to be agreed to take the car in. So then again, the distributor couldn't buy all those cars, so the banks bought them. So we find the banks, all the lots full of cars around that country, your deposits on those, you don't know it, but the bank managers were eager to be sure they're getting rid of those. And so far, I've stopped an hour, he's done pretty well. And the equities they have, I say, are such that they could, might can go fairly far off. But what Walter Chrysler discovered was that if you advance car number one, your best car, too fast, it deteriorates the value of your second-hand cars. It accelerates the deterioration, and the banks would not allow the automobile companies in Detroit to advance the models. They could be really quite superficial, whereas what they did was to then make a superficial change in the body. And then the styling departments, all automobile companies, they're putting clay in the mudguards, making these a little more streamlined each year, and then just making them so the mudguards and everything outside look different, the exactly the same chassis. There were gradually improvements of the better brake in where the brake is. There was some engineering that did get better, but this is really very slow, and changes were really superficial. So the banking equity was not in jeopardy. In other words, it was not a matter of the automobile companies wanting to produce the maxi car. They just found they couldn't. Now, I tell all that to you because after World War II found all the enormous production capability of Detroit, wanting to get in on the enormous money of World War II. So that they had to agree to give up the automobile production and while they're getting out the tanks and everything else. But all the automobile companies then agreed one with the other, and they advertised it. Everybody wanted remember when they got back to have a nice old car, I want my real Franklin, nice new Franklin, that's going to be just like that car. So they advertised that this is what G.I. Joe wanted, and so we'll keep everything for me. So they kept all their dies. Now, a new tooling of a car costs my figures, I haven't had this recently. In 1951, I know it cost about $70 million to retool a new car. So they don't like to spend that kind of money. At any rate, they agreed to keep their tools. World War I technology advances incredible. It meant then when the war was over, Italy and the foreign people were not in this mass production, but were really producing cars, really one off still, were very, very advanced. And American companies came in, got out all the old dyes, and they couldn't compete with the beautiful technology of the rest of the world. As a consequence, they found the distributors didn't like their automobile business anymore. The cars were not selling with the ease that they did. General Motors and Ford got enormous building programs where they got fancy new quarters for Cadillac and very continually upping the sales room, trying to make things look more schmaltzy and so forth. But the distributor found that he just having a very hard time to sell his cars because, in the meantime, labor rates are going up, everything going up, and the margin of 30 or 40% that the distributor had was really eaten up by everything, his rents and the works. He was going through a terrific headache and making no money. So that he said, I'm going to give up my dealership. And they realized he was a very good man. They didn't want to lose him. So what the automobile company started doing was designing a perfectly good car, but deliberately putting in inferior metal into this part or that part. It looked like just the way the parts should look, and so it should really fool your eye all right, but it was designed to wear out in a hurry. So they guaranteed that all their dealers selling cars, that the customers would come back at least once a month and would pay so much. And what they did then was to advance the prices of the parts in the catalog. Where if you want to put together a car out of the parts catalog of Buick and so forth, it costs 4 or 5 times what the Buick cost. So that the only way they were able to keep their dealers was this is where the words design and obsolescence came from. That America then started really cheating itself, its big own business, deliberately fooling its own people. This is a fundamentally very unhealthy matter. But I'll come to the point now that I'm renting my cars, and I found that when I rent the car, because because General Motors and Ford own their Avis and their Hertz and so forth, then they maintain the car, they don't put in the bad parts. So when I rent my car, I get a very superior car to anything I can buy, I assure you. And I can get a pretty new, almost a new car every time, and it's really very pleasant. And I can keep it as long as I want it. I go out for Christmas time in California with my family, I'll rent a car for a month. And it's my car just as much as it ever was in my car. There's no kidding about it. So this is pure kidding myself about owning it. And so I simply see this way it's going to go. I find ownership becoming increasingly onerous. I have moved a number of times and just finding very valuable, lovely old things that our grandmothers and grandfathers gave us, stolen. And we begin to want to move from town to town, and it costs you $25,000 and so forth. The ownership is becoming increasingly onerous. And I find all the big corporations are really realizing that, so Chrysler and Ford really, and they got to get in the renting business. And this is exactly what I said to you earlier. The only industries that are going to survive are going to be giving services. And they're going to be giving good services. And they're going to be continually really improving the product, because the better the product, the more people use it. So if they earn just on the frequency of giving good service, it gets into a very different kind of a drive from what it's been when they're trying to get you to buy something and leave it up to you to get rid of it. Now, I talked to you a lot about these things, go off in these drives, and I had this is then relative, all these things I'm saying to you, to the talk I gave you the other night about monies and backings and world economics and what's on the books and so forth. So you really, the best I can, I want to get to feel and understand the kind of an accounting revolution that will come about. They go from the ownership over to service, they go from the just ownership and blindly to know-how. And the understanding that the important part of wealth is the know-how part, that the material just in the rock by itself is nothing. Now, there was another aspect I left out talking to you about, because we came really to the end of time, and that was I pointed out to you that the building industry was the last of the one-off industries, where automobiles have gotten, vehicles gotten into mass production, and your watches and your clocks and everything else is in mass production. And you could really get out a very great deal of capability for humanity at a very low price that way. But the last and only phase of man's activity that was not in that industrialized mass production world was the building world. So the building goes, oh yes, we do. We mass produce nails and we mass produce bricks and so on. But it wasn't then the parts were the kind. It was the assembly. And when you begin to assemble a building out and it's raining, no environment control, and man's hands are freezing, they got to stop work with the wind. There's no waste. You have to do things under controlled conditions. You have to really produce under the most optimal conditions. That's what we do with everything else. Anyway, at the time of, I point out to you, all the buildings of Italy, so beautiful castellos, done with slaves, didn't cost them money. You just put a whole lot of people to work and built your building. But when labor and humanity began to share equally and get some equal enjoyment of our economy, as labor is able to finally, by developing its unions, to force itself into such a position, then you really had to pay people properly, you couldn't afford the building. So that we have the building industry, as I said, was really obsolete at the time of the great crash, when then the banks took in these farms of really unwanted kind of living equipment, and we then began to rehabilitate the mortgages, and we from there on the government continued its financing, doing it by guaranteeing, telling the bank it could go then and give mortgages on the buildings, and it was all simply because of a fundamental U.S. subsidy of the building industry. What I didn't tell you yesterday was then that we've gone on then, and this enormous mortgaging, and the government taking over the fundamental risk of all the mortgages. At the time of the New Deal, the national debt was the largest it had ever been in history. It was $36 billion. It's really an amazing matter that we come into World War I where national debt was approximately zero. Something would get into a billion once in a while, but get cleaned up. It's a very new matter to get into such big figures, and the great clash really occasions getting up to $36 billion. Things that Pettiers were trying to end it into between 1929 and a New Deal coming in 1933. At any rate, the national debt is now up to, and the interest on that $33 billion was, as I remember it, it was very, very low at the time, about 3.5%. And the interest on it was somewhere in the magnitude of $1 billion a year. Interest had it, the government had to pay the banks. We've now gotten to where the national debt is approaching $600 billion. It's over half $1 trillion. And we're paying these incredible usurious rates of interest, so that we're at a point now where the annual interest the government's having to pay the banks is greater than the national debt of the time of the deal began. An incredible trickery has been done here, and out of that national debt, about $300 billion represents what the United States had to go into debt in order to finance the building industry, which was absolutely obsolete when they took it over. That's what it cost to finance an obsolete industry for a third of a century. I assure you that the building that we've known, the architecture you've been in, the whole game is absolutely over. It's all stopped altogether. And if we do survive on our planet and we stop using our highest technology and so forth just to kill, going for the killing rate, and apply airspace technology and the physicists and so on, how do you really make life work? To man's living room. You get the chemists, the physicists really working on how to use the human waste. I said, no scientist ever asked to look at the plumbing. I was able to really find that out. What an amazing thing. That when we really have science really looking at the living room, then things are going to change very, very greatly. Please understand. And I know absolutely highly feasible today for us to bring to fly a whole city into position. It's like being a whole fleet in the harbor. And one day you can fly a whole city into position and move it tomorrow. Those are the kind of things that are going to be happening, so that when you see the kind of buildings we now have here are going to be going to make very good mines, nice iron mines and so forth, good copper mines, et cetera. But they must be thought of that way. And so we're in a point where the United States is bankrupt. It is fallen in deadness. It's just you can't touch it. And the American human beings, the money equities are down to the game is still going on out there. It's going to be a long time for people to really know for Sunday. It's not going to work here, and then we're going to be very badly stymied. But as I said, it's going to come on here really very silently. The big money honey monopoly has lost its ad, and they're just not going to announce to you that they're all the money game's through. Never do. You might simply going to have to find it out. So that once you realize that. It is important that I have been able to keep my position of being considered apolitical, that my whole strategy had been in artifacts and not in trying to reform the man, not to get into politics. Therefore, I find myself being trusted. I really find myself, it's amazing that I'm trusted by the Russians, and I find myself, when this is just before Christmas, I was asked to speak to the State Department's Foreign Service school, a year school of the top men who are going to represent the United States in the civil service, who will become an ambassador or something, and have this year's school. And for me to talk the way I'm talking to you here, and Sonny Applewhite was with me, and they, it's a, how many Sonny's? 34 people, something like that.
Yeah.
And the, for these kind of people to stand up and give you an ovation is very strange. But when I'm really saying that their service is real all through, and they're giving you an ovation still. So then I want you to realize I'm not speaking as a subversive or something. I'm simply saying that I've had experience to see. I'm just telling you what I've seen, and this way I operate, and as you get to, and the people who are expert in any field say yes, as well. So, did I leave anything else out now? No, those are the things that I realized that I hadn't fully developed for you the other night. That I got pretty close to it, but I want you to really feel when we come now, because my own function, which I expose you to as a grand strategy, is that of the design science. And what are the challenges of the design science? And they are then, how do I arrange to get humanity look out for life support, so that it really can prosper, really look out for that new young life that it does not get. The ill condition reflexes of yesterday, debilitating its perceptivity and its resourcefulness and curiosity and dismaying it. So you have that young world coming along, able to really quite fearlessly, spontaneously employ these principles of nature which we now learn enough about. But I now know and can see and really spell out the technical feasibility of looking out for all humanity, the highest standard anybody's ever known, and do so for all the generations to come, and doing so on our energy income and not on our savings account, which the fossil fuels are. Now that I know that can be done, and therefore, as I said to you the other day, this meant, then I know that politics are obsolete, because they only be founded on, it had to be you or me. There were theories of how to get on as you or me. Like which is going to be the preferable me? That's what the bias of politics is about. I know that's obsolete. I know the war is obsolete. I know really approximately everything we've been engaged in is obsolete. Against. And here are all these brilliant human beings, and they really are brilliant all around the world. They're beautiful. What are we all going to get to thinking about? So. In the hours and days, the hours that I still have left with you, and I think we're down to possibly 12, 15 hours, something like that. It's not very much. I've got a whole lot I'd like to cover. I have lots and lots more pictures and so forth, and I'd like to just show you a few of them to give you a feeling of the reality, because remember what I've said, I must deal in artifacts. I must not talk about the artifacts until I've reduced it to practice. In other words, you just don't talk about bright ideas. Everybody has bright ideas, and anybody can talk about it. I got a great invention. Nothing at all. And if I'm thousands of people that have that invention, and they're doing nothing about it. So the whole thing is, can you reduce it to practice? Does society really permit this thing? It's a very big test, and what I really learned out of reduction to practice has been by far the largest amount of my learning. So I think if I show you a few slides of things I've been involved with and so forth, you can understand why I had to have a better map projection. I had to see my world. I wanted to see what the shop looks like. What does the environment we're doing in look like? And I'd like to now show a few slides of and while I may seemingly bring in subjects I've talked to you about before, this we're looking at now, what they call geoscope. I want to see the world a little better than just in my map, and I've since been given a paper, incidentally, on a number of people historically that I did not know about until about a week ago, when I started reading this paper. It's a beautiful paper. The number of people who had a feeling about how to get humanity to see the Earth in a little better way. And so the great world's fairs and the Paris Exposition, the time the Eiffel Tower, they were planning a big miniature Earth. I got into miniature Earth in quite a lot, and I think I told you a little about the one, for instance, we have at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. Have I talked about that? No. All right. But what you're looking at right this minute is a sphere, which is a miniature Earth, on the roof of the electrical engineering building at Cornell University, where in 1951 I had one of the architecture classes, and we went in for this project. And this beautiful structure was built. It was an 8-frequency geodesic, and it was built with very delicate wood slats. We can get down to, remember, you get what's called a two by a half, but it's really stretched out of something very much stretched. It's these long, very nice clear slats. And we made the structure out of those light, clear pine slats. They're painted blue. And being painted blue, they had very much a feeling of water, as you look at it there. And you could see through the thing, so it had sort of this transparency of the water. It had an extraordinary water effect. Now, what we did, because I had my trigonometry very, very accurate, I was able to coordinate the mathematical coordinates, the latitude longitude grid very accurately with my geodesic grid. And we found then, you now are used then to the icosahedron, it has 30 edges. And each edge of the icosahedron or tetrahedron, any of these structures, the omnitriangulated structures, the edge has what they call a domain. Edge has a domain where it owns up to the center of gravity of the two faces which it divides on the surface. So if you take these two centers of gravity, the two triangles adjacent, perpendicularly away from the edge, and join the ends of the edge together with those center of gravity, you get a diamond. And as there are, with the 30 edges of the icosahedron, there are also then 30 diamonds. Just look, for instance, at the octahedron. I said there's a domain of edges. Domains of edges then are up to the centers of gravity of the faces that divide. So there's an edge, and it divides this face from that face. So owns that this edge up the center of gravity up to here, and this edge here owns up the center of gravity there, and each one owns up to. So if I connect the centers of gravity of the octahedron and its vertex, you get a center of 12 diamonds, and those 12 diamonds will be the rhombic dodecahedron. If you extend the center of gravity outward a little, this becomes that. So that the domains of vertexes are also then connecting the centers of gravity between the adjacent faces and a circle around it. That's where you get the dodecahedron and so forth. Those are domains of vertexes. So the dodecahedron is the domains of the vertexes of the icosahedron. So I want you to understand what I mean by these special characteristics of the sort of domain of the face in the face itself. Now, I had then, for the Cornell Dome, we had there are 30 diamonds that coincided then with the, which I had the mathematical coordination with the latitude longitude grid of our Earth. And we broke up our project into these, more than that. Each of the 30 diamonds, being a diamond is more or less, it's called a parallelogram because it's in the flap. You can then make a perpendicular line, and here's a diamond face, right? Make a line going like that, parallel to the two edges of it. That make it then a thin, what we call a raft, R-A-F-T. So we had 60 rafts. And we then had what we did was to lay down, took pieces of large wrapping paper, the size of one of these diamonds of the icosahedron, the raft. And they did put on the geographical coordinates, latitude, longitude, and then plotted the land, the edges of the land. We then, there were 60 students, so they each had one of these rafts, and then each of them then took a chicken wire mesh. It was a half-inch chicken wire mesh. And they rolled that out flat on the drafting boards, and they then laced it to the wrapping paper so that they could then cut the chicken net to conform exactly the same shape, and it's fastened to the paper. And we have then the outlines of the land on the paper below it. If it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, it may not be in the land, so there's no lines. Then we took bronze fly screen, a beautifully fresh bronze fly screen, and it had some kind of plastic treatment, so it kept its shininess. And we cut out the continental areas for that particular piece of the chart and sewed it onto the chicken wire. Then when we made our dome of these slats and so forth, there were diamond areas identified, and the students were able then to take their raft of chicken wire with its bronze screen corresponding to the land and fasten it into place on the dome. And when they did so, then finally the whole surface of the earth is represented by, and so that where it's just a chicken mesh and blue, come back to then you see the blue painted structure, but the chicken mesh you can't see, it's invisible to you from the distance, and the bronze screen you can see, the sun is reflecting from it. So the bronze screen then gave the exact continental outline. What you're looking at in this picture is the upper left middle would be the Bering Straits. You're seeing Alaska draws you here, and we're looking the northern part of Siberia, and you can see that. Now, I think actually the picture is reversed, I'm sorry to say. And the upper right hand there, sort of floating bronze, that is Greenland. Is back around the wrong way. It would be good if they do turn it, and then we'll be able to talk about it a little more intelligibly. And then what we did with our sphere. Now you can really see, you can see the Greenland, and you can see the Alaska, and it begins to make sense. You can see Kamchatka, there's a peninsula coming down there, and you can see Japan over on the right-hand side, etc. Now, strangely, if you do look at those photographs coming in to our planet from the moon, so whether you can see through cloud cover, strange enough, we do get this kind of a blue transparency, and we get the bronze, like color for the land. It seemed to be a strangely good representation, and seen from a distance. I mean, I have the next picture, because in the next picture, from for this, you can see it began to look more and more like our planet, as it does if you come in out of space. I'm going to now keep that picture a little bit, because it gives you the next thing we did. With our miniature Earth now, we mounted it up on the roof on tripods at considerable height. And we oriented the sphere in such a way that its axis, its north pole-south axis, was exactly parallel to the real Earth's axis. And then we rotated the sphere around its north pole-south axis so that Ithaca, where Cornell is in New York, was in zenith. So the way our big planet Earth is oriented in the heavens, Ithaca is in this direction, and the little miniature. So the little one was mimicking the exact posture of the big Earth in the universe. The distance to the nearest star being 92 million miles away and so forth, and even from any other star group in the sun, if you could ever see such a little light as our Earth reflecting the sun's light, you would not have, for any distance apart, you would never know whether you were looking at a at the little, my miniature Earth are the big one, because their centers are only 4,000 miles apart. And the distance of 4,000 miles apart is absolutely undetectable. So the little Earth is exactly the same attitude, and if something happens to the big Earth, it's fine. It has the same attitude in the heavens. Now, this is what happens, incidentally, if you have a boat on the davits of the Queen Mary. And the boat on the davits is parallel to the Queen Mary's keel. And so whichever way the Queen Mary has, the little boat has. And the big Queen Mary is stepping, the little boat is stepping. From inside the little boat, and observing just what the little boat does, you know exactly what the Queen Mary is doing. Relation to the heavens and the stars and compass and everything. So that I want you to realize that it became really a cool miniature Earth. And what you saw, we had this tripod, I said, and the tripod legs came up through the Indian Ocean. Happened to be very convenient they came that way, so they didn't go through any of the continents. And we could go up a ladder on the tripod, and there was a platform, and the center of the tripod is the exact center of the Earth, offset by a little distance. So you put your chin on the top of the tripod, your eye was at the center of the sphere. So what you saw with your chin on the tripod was exactly what you'd have seen if you had took an elevator down the center of the Earth from Ithaca, always keeping Ithaca above you here, and what you look out at, if you had X-ray eyes, any star in zenith over any continent would be there. So the students became fascinated by that, because inside there we could see all the stars, you see. It was really lovely. Didn't block them at all. Even through the fly screen, no trouble at all. So, here's, for instance, at the first night it happened, the Big Dip was over the North American continent. And they were able to get on the telephone and check that star's in zenith over that point. It was absolutely true counterterm. Like the offset of the star, no error whatsoever in this 4,000 mile. Offset from the center. You don't get really any difference as you're going around the sun, orbiting here. Very little displacement difference, let alone that much of a difference. So that they're making 60,000 miles an hour around the sun, so it's not often, not long before you get that kind of differential very fast. Now, so I want you to understand, this is miniature Earth, and for the first time in history, I think, grown-ups in there, and we spent luckily a beautiful night the first night we finished it. It was a lovely May evening. And as you're in there, first place on the roof, you could come down about on the, what you're looking at the roof side nearest you, this side of the sphere. The north was in the other direction, so if you looked up through, looked through the south pole of the miniature Earth, and move yourself so the south pole is exactly on the north pole of the miniature Earth, then there was a pole star right there. Just lovely, and you could see that, you see all that. So inside it, when you stood really looking facing north on the platform, which we made arranged very easy for you to do, then you realize that the pole star is staying right there. And you began to realize that the nearer you came to your left and right near the equator, the more rapidly the wires were passing the stars. So you began to really feel the rotation. At the first time, suddenly began to really realize our Earth was evolving. You became so absolutely convinced of its right attitude that there was somebody evolving in Australia. On that axis, polar axis, you really felt it. The kids stayed there all night, and the next day we began even, it was fascinating that the chicken mesh wire, and that was rather even the little bronze wire, was such that a star, just the refraction of light just bending around the wire, you really could feel these things and the glisteningness. It was a very, very impressive experience. So, this then had to do with getting you and I hooked up with the universe. I've met quite a number of these since. The idea was to get to bigger and bigger ones, and from Cornell I went to the University of Minnesota, where we undertook to do the 200-footer, We never did get it finished. I told you about doing that polyester fiberglass, and then I went on to Princeton, and Princeton decided we would really, really lick this business, and we worked for 3 years on a project at Minnesota, and then three successive years at Princeton, and it got to where it needed quite a lot of money, and we found that we could do all the, instead of having to use, we'd have just electric lights on the sphere, and many, many, many of them, and they would simply illuminate, and we found we didn't even have to draw the outlines, because we could then have a computer light the lights to outline anything you wanted, and then attitude you wanted, so forth. But realize that back of the UN building in New York, in the East River, is what used to be Blackwell's Island, and then it became Welfare Island, and it had all kinds of insane asylums and city prisons on it. Gradually, those were moved away. They built a new island of refuge up there to the south, and all those things up there. Today, that's has now been renamed Roosevelt Island. Anyway, south of Blackwell's Island is Blackwell's Ledge, with bell buoys and so forth, a whole group of rocks in the water. And they're right, actually, out to the east of the United Nations building. And what I wanted to do was to build them a miniature Earth mounted from those rocks, having mass, and mounted in cables. It would weigh so very little, the cables would be really invisible, and it seemed to be floating out there. It looked like a miniature Earth that's come in close to our Earth here. And it's at the United Nations building, we made it so it's going to be 200 feet in diameter, be mounted 200 feet above the water, so it'd be the height, that'd be 400 feet, be the height of the United Nations building. So it would be a miniature Earth really out confronting the representatives of the world. And we wanted to have on it, actuating everything that's going on, where there's all the bonfires are, all those fires must be burning, and so we really continually have the world looking at itself and looking at the consequences and getting the different kind of viewpoints that you can get. So at one time this looked like it'd be around $10 million, and then I'm sure today it costs a bit more, but it was a feasible sum. Now the 200 foot diameter was because the height at which the Air Force started flying mosaics of the world before we got the satellites. The lowest area, the height that it flew from, and making aerial mosaics of Europe and Germany and so forth, whatever they might be, was at the height where if you took the 35 millimeter photograph made by them, and you put 35 millimeter photographs together edge to edge, you'd make a 200 foot sphere. You could take a direct photograph, and in those photographs, you can make out, you can see all the streets and everything, you can see individual humans' houses, but you can't see the humans. But you can really see our home. You know that's your home, just as clear as can be, you pick it out. So that I wanted some way in which we had a scale where human beings could really feel themselves on the earth. Even though they couldn't quite see themselves, they'd really feel, these are my works, and the house is part of me, so that was a scale. Now, we have built one for the religious center at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville campus. That's a 50-footer. And the different religions, or the leaders of different religions, needed to have something on campus, and they pooled their monies together and had this religious center built. And it really does what we said. You go in to go out to the universe. and you go in to go, and you get out of the universe in a hurry. To go in, to go out. Now, and that is you're looking at the religious center at the editor right now, that picture. Now, I'm going to go through a number of pictures, thinking about things in a geoscopish kind of way. I get this name, geoscope, and I tried miniature Earth. I had different kinds of ways of talking about it. Next picture, please. We're back then to Cornell. Incidentally, this is the way it looked on the campus, and I'm sorry to say that the next four Halloween students from other parts of the university, this sphere looked very attractive to them, and somehow they scale the building to get on top, and they want to get down and roll it around the campus for Halloween to do, but they put it over the edge and let it drop and smash it. It's sad things do happen when development projects. It was a very, very rich experience. Next picture. This is in London. A number of universities now have been making my geodesic for doing the sphere in transparency. So it's really quite easy to make quite a large sphere transparent. You have your air breathing problems and so forth. Next picture. That is another one of those in London. Next picture. I'll just give you then again, some of you already looked at where the people are on our planet. Next picture. And the ill design of the Mercator. Next picture. I'm just going really quite fast. The water ocean world, the British Empire. Next picture. And the air ocean world, where going from east west to abrupt north south, and integrated the whole world instead of being all divided. And Canada coming in because they have the greatest proximity to China and Russia and so forth. There is the Edwardsville campus of Southern Illinois University happens to have running through the grounds the 90th meridian of our Earth, 90 west. As you know, the meridians, you add the two amounts of the east and the west, and they must make up to 180 degrees. And so the 90 is the only one where the 90 east and 90 west are the same, something like our 45 degree, 45, 90 south degrees, right triangle. So 90 west and the Edwardsville campus, I got the chancellor of the university to allow me to build our building exactly on the 90th meridian. So the 90th meridian runs right through, is the axis, our north-south axis, actually greatest survey accuracy. So we have a strip running out from the building of the 90th meridian. Now that 90th meridian runs north and goes through very strategic, but it comes down through Bangladesh, comes right through the center of population, the most highly concentrated of all of humanity. And you find that the 90th meridian really becomes a highway. Then if you want to get one meridian nearest to most people, it would be it. And it is that north and south one. Next picture, please. Now we're looking at the world as if you lived in South Africa. I spoke to you about the couriers coming from Australia to Churchill during World War II, and I put the pieces together with Australia at the center. I said, well, that's the way the world map. That's where the world is. Why don't people make maps that way? So this one is South Africa's viewpoint. Next picture. This is a North Pole viewpoint. Yes. Next picture. And this is a United States viewpoint. Next picture. And here we have India's viewpoint. Next picture. And this is the equatorial stretch out. You can go take on my map piece and go right around the equator that way. Next picture. This is making an equator of the, this is the path I gave you of the going around the world where you don't touch any continents. But it is a path of where all the astronauts, all our vehicles went off on this path every time. Next picture. Now, I'm going to show you something here quite interesting, this over the north flying. Way back in 1927, when I started my work, I really commend myself very much to an over the pole north world. And as World War II was coming on, I told you I used to be on the science technology consultant for staff of Fortune magazine. Also, I was a main advisor to Life magazine. And Life magazine asked me, after I left Time Incorporated, if I would come in as consultant. And they were planning, they wanted to get up an issue. They were reporting World War II in a very big way, and it had been joined by the Germans and the English and so forth. The United States was not quite in yet. This was before Pearl Harbor. The life staff asked me if I would get up a grand strategy of the best way to lick Hitler's. You know, Hitler was then rushing, pushing everybody in the water. And he was in central England there and pushing people to the water and into the water. And they asked me if I could develop a grand strategy for the United States. Later on, I learned the grand strategy that was taken on by the United States was Churchill's grand strategy. He called it the soft belly. He had the Americans come in to go to South America and across to North Africa, and then come in under the soft belly to Sicily and Italy. That this was the weakest part. And instead of trying to go across the channel. Later on, they do go to the channel, but not until they weaken things very much from the south. And they asked me if I could develop a grand strategy which would lick Hitler. And so I proposed going immediately over the Arctic and flying all the logistics, not doing ships at sea, but getting into towing, airplanes that were towing, tongue airplanes that were pulling gliders. Which was, they was used a great deal during the war. But enormous gliders, the gliders are to be designed in such a way as to be actually usable as part of buildings and so forth after they landed. And without a complete logistic, they were great plywood cylinders, and you had a standard nose that would go on them, you had a standard tail that went on them, and you had a standard wing section that went on them, and they just had to be gliders to be towed. And I had friends in the Air Force who were working on tow gliders, so that I found that a practical thought. And I was going to use them. The wing sections became parts of the roof section, and the cylinders, after they emptied all the cargo out of them, became columns for assembly, for factories, assembly buildings and so forth. And then I proposed coming in and joining up with Russia and pushing Germany into the water, because you had to get behind it. And anyway, the life staff got very excited by this, and they spent a month or two working with me, and they got up, so we finally published it in Life. And this is a piece. Next picture, this, and then that was the cover of Life, that where that came out. Next picture, then this is a letter which you can't read, written to me by the senior editor who did all the war things of Life at that time, telling me, certifying about this being my strategy, because all the meetings were held at his house, and because something very, very interesting happened. They didn't put my name on the story. I left after that, I went to Washington. I became head mechanical engineer of the Board of Economic Welfare. There's a man named Gary Underhill who was the great strategic arms man, advisor on Life magazine. He'd grown up in the Army, United States Army, son of a general, and he knew all the clothing, you know, trappings of every division of any of the German Army, and incredibly well informed. He'd been taken to Washington then as head of one of the departments, and I think it's G2 or something like that. One day in Washington, he asked me to come have lunch with him, and he gave me a copy of Wehrmacht. Wehrmacht was the German military, of their great military magazine. And they published in the format of Life, more or less copying it. But it was the only real big news that the army, the armed forces of Germany had was the Wehrmacht. And in this copy of the Wehrmacht, they had a reproduction of the Life article. And the German general said this is the only way we could be licked. They said the Americans are too naive to do it. It was really very interesting to have such a document. And so the head of G2 gave me the Wehrmacht magazine to take home, and I have it. And the boys are getting ready for this show, photograph the old Wehrmacht magazine there. But I just do that to show you how you really can, by being a comprehensive, get to really see things. So the things I've been saying to you about where we are in economics at the moment, I realize that I have had insights many times of what way things are really stacking up. And I hope this helps to just give you some confidence in things I'm saying. Next picture. This is just more of the Wehrmacht story. Go through quite fast. They're the towing the gliders. Next picture. How you take off with them and so forth. We went into really absolute detail about this, and then the other experts that life took on were able to really get into all the armaments, everything would be necessary for the proper attack. Next picture. Do you go down, please, these pictures? Yes, this is the cover of their marks that their statement came out on. This would be about it's just about the time my map came out in the winter of 43, early in the winter of 43. Next picture, please. That's the reproduction in Wehrmacht. Next picture. Now here I'm showing you something else, because I've been talking about tensegrity. I explained to you about pneumatics and that the tensegrities really are then visible. The compression members in the tensegrity are visible paired molecules of gases going in two directions. And this is now a geodesic dome made in the following way. You're used to pneumatic buildings. We have the whole thing filled with air. But here we don't do that. We have two geodesic domes, one about 6 inches greater radius than the other. And all the pattern is done very neatly in the right dimensions. And one is sewn inside the other. And there are webs on the triangular lines, web between the two. Then we just let air into this between, so that the atmosphere makes the inner one, as I said, with the metal one, pushes it outwardly, and right, they just say absolutely by themselves. You don't need to have air inside the whole dome, or have air inside the wall, provided because we know how the molecules operate because they go in the Dynaxian pattern. So here's one that we've made. Could you remove me from the picture? And that I have it supine, and we've made them with compressed air bottles so that they could be dropped by helicopter or airplanes. These were all dropped by airplanes over the Arctic. And there are great, enormous islands of ice that float over the Arctic. And scientific teams were put onto those since World War II, and this is what they lived in. This made a beautiful dome, and they had a sponge rubber floor about 6 inches deep, as good insulation against the ice. I got many, many letters from scientists living in those domes. And next picture. It just popped open. It just touched the thing, and the thing gives it shape right like that. And you can see then your triangulation, and you can see how the webbing is done. Next picture. There's a man standing on top. It's just a rigid steel. Now, I saw that you could go even further than that. That we could cut out the webs of the triangles, because it was only the triangular forms, so that's where the pattern of the molecules go in. Next picture. So here is then a geodesic made where you only have a plenary chamber of the tubes themselves. And this is the shape it takes. This pops, it always automatically comes like shape. I want to give you more and more confidence and experiencing with me. I say the reduction to practice and you'll really learn whether your theories are right or wrong. So I've given every kind of a test I can, and it's proven up absolutely superbly. Pneumatics, this is the shape it's going to want us to take. It takes it. Next picture. Now, here I've talked to you about delivering whole cities by air. In the 1927, when I started in on thinking about dwelling machines for human beings and mass production dwelling machines to live in, and environment controls, I then said, you can't assemble things and move them over the highways, because the railroad bridges automatically would be like a sausage machine and give it a shape. That's exactly why the trailers are the shape they are. They're not only 8 inches, eight feet wide and such and such a height. So they're extruded by the bridges. And I said, I've got to have some way of delivering the dwelling dwelling facilities, the environmental controls, by air to be transcendental to any bridge or anything like that. So that I got into them, assumed right from the outset, the air delivery of buildings, and I assumed right from the outset that I must meet the most formidable conditions. So my first thoughts actually were of installing, delivering a 10-deck building, which would be used by, I remember I was in the Navy, and this, I'm doing my thinking the year of the Lindbergh flight, and I'd come out of thinking about the Navy strategy to getting across the ocean and be stepping stones. You'd go to several islands. You wouldn't try to do it all in one piece. You'd like to make it a little safer. And they had then, I said you could fly over the Arctic because the radio here, their water spaces had opened up. So I planned a building for a maintenance crew, aeronautical maintenance crew, who would live in the Arctic, and we'd have then stepping stone flights over the Arctic and be able to take care of them. But it had to be a building then was so absolutely complete that people just moved in. They didn't have to have any time. They were free, so they're putting it up and so forth. So I went into the study of the... This picture is really sad because the upper right-hand corner there is, and it should be on the left here, there's a Zeppelin. I had gotten then into what weight was necessary using a spine and tensegrity forms of tension webbing and so forth to make a 10-deck building. What weight could I really get down to? And I found that to do all the things we really needed to do. And I got down to a weight which I found the year 1927, called the scantlings of the design data on the Graf Zeppelin, which was about to be built at in Germany, were given, and what she could carry, what a useful carrying load would be. And I found my 10-deck building could be carried by the Graf Zeppelin. Therefore, next, go back to that picture again, if you don't mind, please. I had then this is a cartoon, and in the upper left-hand corner cartoon, I had the Zeppelin with the building, 10-deck buildings suspended horizontally below the Zeppelin. It looks just like a very large cabin on the Zeppelin. And the Zeppelin drops a bomb to make a crater. And then they lower the building down into the crater hole. You can see the crater hole in the middle top picture. And they go down and they put fill it in again, planting it like a tree. And it had all of its integral sewage disposal and everything in the thing went down the bottom there. Anyway, I found it was, I knew I was not going to be loaned the Graf Zeppelin and so forth, but I knew that I was actually working within logistical limits, that it was a feasible matter to talk about delivering a 10-deck building by air. And I said, by giving myself the worst condition you could possibly have, the North Pole, this would be the test. I got to have some limit conditions. And there'd be no building department at the North Pole to say you can't do it. It's very interesting that the first real use of my geodesic domes was exactly that. It got to be the radomes for the defense early warning system of the northern end of Thule and so forth. But nothing else would do it. Anyway, there is your 10-deck building. And the 10-deck building, it's done with, you see all this wire work and had pneumatic floor triangles and so forth. It had, like ships, built-in booms. The upper right-hand side, you see, there is an enormous aerial. There's also a vertical windmill of the Flettner type, and there are built-in arms, like the booms on ships for loading. And if you remove my figure from the picture for a minute and look at the lower left-hand corner, and you see a bathroom being hoisted on a cable by the boom to be brought into the building. As you bring everything big in the building from outside, and you just open the building on the side to string things in instead of trying to bring things through central elevators, which is really a very poor way to do. But if you load the way you can, a ship just swing the sides of the buildings open, swing big things in, and close them up again, lock them up. Anyway, this is the way this whole thing was designed, and I want you to see that it did then have, right from the outset, integral use of wind power, and it had its tank in the base had a all plans for using the human waste and so forth, the energies that were in them, because as of that time, it had already been proven at the chemical engineering section of the farm engineering of University of Illinois at Urbana, that the amount of methane gas in the human family waste of farm family would be enough actual of energy to run the farm machinery at the time. So that, incidentally, one little man took them seriously and went and developed the automobile in 1929, and the UN, I went to a meeting in the UN last year, they asked me to come down there, and this little man has been running his automobile on the methane gas in the family ever since 1929. he was no trouble at all. And right, once you get the early 1927 plans for the Dymaxian house and buildings, once you understand what is in there, you had to be totally responsible for all the needs of the human beings are going to be in there, and you had to be able to deliver and take away. Next picture. I said that because this picture and the one picture before, could you go back one picture of the airlift? In 1954, which is quite a long time after 1927, the United States Marine Corps, the head of the aviation logistics, had been found that the United States Marines and the Army and so forth had really no proper air deliverable environment controls. And they'd given out contracts to General Motors and had given out some large number of contracts, I think some 20 or 30 large contracts, two-year contracts, somebody developed air deliverable environment controls and didn't find it. And suddenly, as Colonel Lane, who's head of the aviation logistics of the Marine Corps, found that I didn't have a geodesic dome. They went into very, very thorough studies of them. This particular one, this is at a place, Orphans Hill in Raleigh, North Carolina. We had, it's 1954, and we had the first lift of my dome. And this is the first time I saw one. My building is now really being practically taken somewhere. And the next picture of it, please. And the next one, we skipped one. We flew it at 60 knots. And so 60 knots where the hurricane begins, so it was a great test of just the hurricane stability of my building. And then we got into the one that you just shown. Could I have that next picture back, or the picture you just ran in again? It was another Marine Corps flying an open frame building. Now that's the very first one, the Orphans Hill lift. Then came one moving at 60 knots to the same dome. But I had to also do my first calculation how you apply the sling to know what how much stress it would be, this distribution of stresses. Next picture, please. It is the open, there we are. Now this is a much later phase of the dome being flown from Quantico, Virginia, the Marine Corps headquarters. And this dome was made out of magnesium tubing. And the Marines, a group of Marines, assembled in 135 man minutes. And it was really quite a sight to see this thing go together. This is a large dome. This is a 50-footer. And so in the 50-footer, you have about 2,000 square feet, 4 feet. It was comfortable for a really quite large, cover all kinds of activities. And the small planes. These then were flown, they began flying these from the aircraft carriers. And it was quite a sight to see them come up on they assembled down the lower deck and came up in the elevator, and then the helicopter take off and fly off the mainland. And they see the skins flapping, they always flew them more than 60 knots. And the helicopter pilots found they behaved beautifully. There was no yawing around, they actually really very steady, really steady tail. Took a comfortable, most comfortable aeronautical position. Next picture. So I just wanted to go back then. The idea of what I had thought could be done, air delivery buildings, for the first time was done in 54 and then began to use bigger and bigger buildings by air. But during World War II in Washington, when I was the Board of Economic Warfare, I also, as I said, head mechanical engineer, but I also was on an inter-agency committee of different agencies of the government, with also with other other foreign governments as allies. And I was on a committee of alternate resources. If something was not available, how would you solve the problem with other resources? And at those meetings, the chairman, normally growled, but he would always, when he saw me come in, he'd always say, please don't ruin our meeting with those houses by air, please. And that was 43. And then by 54, 11 years later, I saw the Marine Corps really flying them. And if the Marines were suddenly starved on their budget, but they had plans to really get enormous numbers of these. The ones they did have, they were on typhoons and Okinawa and so forth. They were the only things that stood up time and again. They were very, very stable. Next picture. The next picture. I just ran those. I want to show. Oh, you'll have to try that. This is a picture of a Piasecki carrying a dome for the Ford Motor Company of 110 feet in diameter. And it's 10,000 square feet of floor space. And that dome they carried around, they brought it in all kinds of shows, and finally that dome went to Seattle and became the Ford Motor Company exhibition dome at the Seattle World's Fair. And this then told me I could really, now we're talking about, again, quite a number of years ago, by then we were able to deliver 10,000 square feet. The curve of increase of capability, because since then we've had Vietnam War and the development of helicopters has just been phenomenal. We're at the point now where it really is truly feasible for it to deliver, I'm going to be able to deliver really stadium covers in a day. We're in that magnitude. In other words, houses, buildings by air could not be more practical. So think about your architecture. Be sure to be thinking about houses by air, buildings by air. That's where it's going to go. And we're going to really manufacture them in the aircraft plants. About, admittedly, after World War II, big aircraft companies trying to find peacetime business before we started giving the aircraft companies a round of jets. They didn't know jets were coming. They were looking for business, and the Lockheed company got into what they called General Panels Company. And that was Conrad Wachsman was the architect, and Gropius at Harvard designed General Panels. And they found they were simply producing units to go into the tailor-made buildings, and that the people who were designing the buildings themselves didn't know what they're doing. They were really making parts for something so inefficient that just was not a good business. About it was about 6 years ago, I had a meeting with the chairman of the board and the chief the vice president in charge of scientific research of Lockheed at Burbank, California. And they talked about their ventures in the general panel, how that was the wrong thing, and that they had, however, been unable, they knew all about my house. They could not really credit it. The Beech aircraft had developed a very good prototype. Lockheed didn't think it was going to happen. But Lockheed said to me that their chief, the vice president in charge of scientific research, that they were now at a point where they were on the actual drawing boards, and most seriously, they were considering the fact that there was a limit to continuing building longer and longer runways of airports for bigger and bigger ships taking off horizontally. You're going to have to get to the vertical. And the English had already licked the vertical takeoff. So Lockheed was really planning its future on the vertical takeoff. That was the only way to carry on, and it might get to the point where you really had vertical tugs, so both for your earliest takeoff, and then you're going to get acceleration ready to take on the horizontal form of the flight. And right, they had their ways of solving those problems, and so they then were no longer limited to the size of runways. They also then cited to me a law that I would cite to you, that every time you double linear dimension, each increase the volume, the payload by 8, and I have only 4 times my surface, so the driving the friction of the skin of the ship of the sea or the ship of the sky, that friction is the fourfold, and the payload is 8. So every time you double the size, you have twice the advantage and delivery of the payload. So the bigger and bigger the ship, the more worthwhile. But the longer, bigger and bigger ships, and the longer the runway. So they said we'd have to go, we want to get in really big ships, we're going to have to go into Vitor. So they were getting into a whole new, they had drawing boards and engineering, very complete and serious studies going on a long time of that era of the vertical takeoff and the really big ship. They were designing and getting into ships, designing them up to 10,000 passengers. And when they got into that kind of a size, they said, suddenly, the relative size of apparatus for your living, so forth, to the totality, synergetics of the big buildings continually improves in such a way that they said it suddenly would be absolutely practical, they could see, for the aircraft industry to be really in the building business, because it'd be highly feasible to build very large skyscrapers in the aircraft plant horizontally, come out horizontally, fly horizontally, and then upend at the site. So that they said that they now, for the first time, this was 6 years ago, accredited my, they could really prove it in the computer, so it would be terribly worthwhile for the aircraft industry to actually get into the building world. This one I'm talking about delivering old cities by air. You understand, this is within the considered feasibility of the serious operators of the aircraft industry today. I know it's highly feasible to deliver whole domes, but then I get the 10,000 square feet floor space, which we were doing back at the time the CL was 4 there. I can give you very, very large domes. I gave you yesterday the energy efficiency that goes up every time you do it. So I've gotten into studies of a whole community under one single dome, where you live in the garden and it's not going to rain on you. And we can conceal all the rain, going to catch it all in the gutter, so you have your water and you don't have to go down the storm sewer, you're going to conserve it. And the things really work out very, very economically, very well. You get what I call the Old Man River project. I want to come back to sort of the larger philosophy in relation to what I've been talking about, these 10-deck buildings and air delivering of the buildings and so forth, because it was 1927. I went to 17 years before I had the first actual witness of an air delivery, and then I saw it really did become a very practical matter, and I'm quite confident we're going to see it in a very, very big way. But the point is, it gets to be, I had to assume about a half century, that it'd be 50 years before it might begin to have true relevance in the economics of man. I plotted many curves on, would give me some clue as to how long you would have to wait for various things, and what I used as most important was the rate of increase of tensile strengths in various metals, particularly getting into the aluminum alloys and the non-ferrous, which were at a very low order of strength when I first started, and have gone up to extraordinary strengths. I also had to assume that in 1927, the largest clear plastic we had was a watch crystal, and it was celluloid, and it was not a watertight at all, and it got yellow very rapidly and scratched very badly. And this is simply what they made celluloid dolls and things like that, and it was highly inflammable. It was not until, well, in 1927 I started these things. That's really all I had to go. They had at that time poker chips, which were opaque, made out of casein from milk. But there were great indications of developments in the plastics, and so I made a working assumption that I would come eventually to clear material that you could see through that would not be glass, would be lighter than glass, and would be almost as scratch-proof as glass, and so forth. I made really a lot of working assumptions like that and tried to use the curves of already developed phenomena, give me some idea how fast I expect the others. So So when I was really designing a structure, a house, a dimaxing house, have windows all around, I was not planning the weight of glass. Glass is very heavy. And so I was waiting on a plastic, and finally a plastic that I'd be able to have hermetically sealed. It is interesting that 4 years ago now, we installed at Bear Island a geodesic dome with pneumatic pillows, triangular pillows, because they will not wave in the wind, because they're both positive and negative curvature. And we filled them with a carbon gas, because they will not fog up the way the air will. Two of those pillows got damaged by little kids the first summer, 4 years ago. The others have been through now 4 winters and many hurricanes, and they're absolute perfect shape. And interesting how superbly they hold up, and there is no leakage to plastic at this point, and nice clear plastic. So inside you can see the stars. It's a beautiful dome to live in. My grandson lives in it. Now, I just mainly at the moment talking about youth is impatient, and I have so many young people or even middle-aged people who have ideas, and they're terribly impatient about how to get this thing going right in a hurry. And that's not the way things are. So I just really want to warn you, and the things that you might feel yourselves constrained to commit yourself to, be sure to really make studies about what your expectancy is, so you're not going to be discontented and so forth. Lots of people have thought I've been frustrated through the years. I've been frustrated for all, because I've realized what's going on is due process and checks and balances, or make sure where gestation has been going on. So I really, actually, it was exciting, because I said 45 to 50 years by expectancy before you really would see serious use of mass-produced houses coming by air and so forth. I think they're going to be this about on. That was 1977. That's quite a long way away, and I wouldn't be too surprised if we really, that's in question. I think you're going to see it. They'll be right on schedule. So I'd like you to have a feeling of the confidence in things, provided you don't just really guess, but do a whole lot of get other rates of change that are contiguous phenomena that give you some kind of a clue about how long you're going to wait for something to happen. I also would like to introduce just this minute I've talked to you about a long time about my daughter, the first daughter having apparently this telepathetic sense, and all of us having certain things happen in our lives sometimes, many times, that we can only explain as telepathy. And I really felt right from the beginning of after I experienced that with daughter. I don't have something called magic. If something is going on, then there's some kind of a generalized principle operating here that you may not be familiar with, but we're going to find out what it is. So the best I could surmise was that there's something called ultra high frequency electromagnetic waves. That was in the early 20s, and we don't have at that time radio waves are a mile long. We didn't have any short waves. Short waves don't come in until the 30s. And we ended World War II, the shortest wave we had was 2.5 meters. But we come out of World War II with very much shorter, getting down into very, very small magnitudes. And as I said, the higher the frequency, the shorter the wave, the more interference. When you go to the little ones, why so much interference you couldn't send any distance. That's why we get these walkie-talkies at very, very high frequency, and with such interference you don't really have to get a license, because you're only going to go for a little short distance. So that, you know, it's not going to involve a whole lot of humanity and very much the environment. Anyway, I want you to think about then before World War II, when the new television was coming, the English already had it. The plans were of those in the electronics world, the market development, market such phenomena. They were planning that. Television then was obviously going to need continual entertainment, the way they'd had announcers, people talking on the radio, and it's going to be a much more expensive kind of shells at when you're going to see things. Therefore, they assumed that it probably have to hook up with Hollywood or New York, because they would not be available in the small towns, the kind of talent you would need to carry on. So they were assuming that they were going to have, because they knew of the interference with ways, the only bands been reserved by the different governments for television were on very high frequency, short waves. So they were assuming coaxial cables running from city to city, and then that they would broadcast locally from high mass that would not have any interference problem with the horizon. And so during World War II, it had not been realized that we were going to get more and more use in the radars, although getting the very, very much shorter waves. And when the war was over, then, and incidentally, we can take a very small, we've mentioned this before, a candlelight. By putting a reflector behind it, you can concentrate that radiation that's going all directions, gets more effective, then put a lens and bring it down even more, and able to get a light of a candle to be seen at several miles away as a lighthouse. So that you can take very small energy outputs and by beaming, very much increase the power of the beaming. I became tremendously interested in beaming, and I wrote quite a lot about it in my book, Nine Chains of the Moon in 1938, when I was assistant to the director of research at Phelps Dodge Corporation, and I was getting into all this copper and much of the electronics world, and I found I prophesy in Nine Chains of the Moon and published in 1938 that we will be beaming power, and I'm quite confident that we are very close to that now. But the business of beaming made me feel it was very interesting then that during World War II we got down to where the waves are short enough to be in a sense reflectable by a very small reflector, a reasonably small reflector. Otherwise it has to have something very big. So that we have then when the World War was over and didn't get into television, began then to send the programs from city to city, not by coaxial cable, but by having transceivers, a sending reflector, and then a receiving reflector at horizon distances, and you find those all around the country, and as they picked up here and then sent out again, they simply boosted the energies to keep going very powerfully done. So I became very interested then in the further thought that I have this experience of being with audiences thousands of times now, and I've got to be able to see the eyes, and something goes on with me and the audiences, and they apparently really do talk to me. And I'm sure one reason I've been able, really quite a few universities where we even started talking at 8 in the morning and ended at 3:30 the next morning at Cal Polytech, things like that. It's because something goes on between the people are able to talk to me, or they wouldn't carry on that long, and I get something back and do respond to what they are thinking. Anyway, I came to the conclusion it could be that our eyes are transceivers, that is, we pick up this way, the waves are so very, very fine, this is easy to pick up, and then we send everything back into our television studio in the brain. Nothing goes on in the eye except this is the transceiver, and it also then sends out. And this became very interesting to me. I've been going over synergetics with you, and I know that just from your eyes speaking to me, you've been surprised quite a number of times by what you're learning. But I have made in my life several hundred real mathematical discoveries that there is no record of anybody knowing of this, it was so before this relationship existed. And every time it has happened with me, I have a very peculiar experience. I always have experience of that this is known long, long ago. I call it intellectual mustard, the sort of feeling of maybe not on earth. This has been known by mind previously and some very long ago time. I get this feeling time again. This has been known, you see. Now, but not necessarily on Earth. Now, I should think about the idea of the eye as a transceiver. We know then that with very small energies, you can beam, but also if you go out through in the sky, don't go through the clouds and so forth, you have really very little interference. Therefore, they've been able to take very low order energy, extremely low energy broadcasting, and they've been beamed a signal and bounced it off the moon with incredibly low amount of output. So I said it could be then when you and I look out through the sky, look at out of the sky, and I look at the stars. And there's a tendency to feel to be very thoughtful looking at those stars. That we may, you know, we might literally be broadcasting. We might be sending out in the stars. And if it doesn't run into some substance, it runs into something, it will bounce and angle off someplace else and still have some value. But if you happen to be looking at the moon the right way, you might get a bounce back if you look at the right point. But not too likely, you might. And at any rate, it seemed to me it could be that we might be really broadcasting out and the signals that don't run into anything will just go on and on and on. So I said it could be that when I have made a discovery, I really have received this information from elsewhere. You know, that I saw it in the sky last night or something, and then I again began to process it, and by today I suddenly am saying it. The message had been deciphered and coded and so forth, and I suddenly getting the message. Now, this began, it introduced me to the thought that all the knowledge that there is of universe may have at various times been known to various people in various places and does get sent out of the universe and gets picked up around the universe. And one of the experiences I do have is that, and you have it too, that there, you have an idea and somebody else, if you don't do something about it, then tomorrow somebody else has it and you said, I wish I'd done something with that. But I think there's an enormous amount of reception of ideas. Certain ideas are synergetically inescapable as a consequence of living in an environment, this happening, this thing. They just go together and make people think them. But there are other ones that seem to me to be pretty remote, the kinds of discoveries I have made from time to time. But I want then to further, I'm trying continually to let you know how I simply see myself as an average organism, and if we begin to pay attention as just sensitive we can be, we may catch on to some of the things that are going on with us, that go on with everybody. And it might be to advantage for us to find out. The fact that we're given and endowed with the capability to find things out, I say we're supposed to be using it. I think it's a very important part of the design of the universe. We're given these capabilities so that we're meant to explore, right, and keep on pushing. But connecting what I'm saying to you now with the idea of patience and trying to understand that we may be really, human beings are really receivers of information, and we're supposed to be doing certain things on our planet. And the whole thing works absolutely superb. It seems to be you. You don't have anybody else to say that's where you got it. So you seem to be acting. But I want you to understand, I look at myself very much as an agent, as I'm trying to be a very effective agent. All of us are. And I'm trying to be a very responsible custodian of information. And I've given you my strategies about that. But look upon, there has to be a Mr. X and a Mr. Y in the universe. In history, and evolution goes that way. So you can perform Mr. X function, but I don't make this a personal matter at all. That this is something to be done, and things can happen for humanity a little more quickly by our being on the alert and really trying to help it happen. It's trying to happen, trying very hard to happen. I try to see what nature's trying to very hard to have happen. She's trying very hard to make man a success. Just trying very, very hard. And he's so used to, he's got such an inferiority complex, so used to being a failure that he doesn't yield on it. Now, I'd like to get back to our picturing and so forth, and there was a last, I was giving you an airlift of buildings, and I started off really, however, talking grand strategy, giving you mini Earth and geoscope, and trying to see things in big ways. And out of my seeing things in big ways, saw that I'd better get traffic of large environment controls into the air. This would be the most comfortable way for them to go. And if they were well designed, they could take the high speeds of hurricane and better velocity deliveries and so forth. So this picture I'm looking at, I remember again, I had that 10-decker for the North Pole. And because I had now found this is feasible, this then made it possible. Now the next picture, I then made myself a world, this before I did my regular map projection. I've rotated the Earth in such a way that you would see the most land in any one picture. And this is it, and Riviera was an exact center of that circle, which seemed interesting because a lot of tycoons would find it a pretty good spot to get in to control things. And at any rate, I made my best picture I could of trying to feel our Earth as a planet. I wanted to get a sense of planet. And this picture has always had that kind of effect. And then on that planet, now that I knew that I could deliver buildings by air, by Zeppelin, I found that practical, then I said, supposing then, we might have some world airlines. We did not have world airlines at the time. Over the Channel flight in England. There was a Florida to Cuba flight at the time I did this. There were possibly one or two other very short jumps. I said, I'd like to think about world airlines, and if I could put air deliver to a hostile place where nobody's been able to go before, environment controls for maintenance crews, I could then think practically of stepping stone flights. And so that I then put on this map, if you look at it carefully, if it's upper left there, you'll see a 10-deck building. And you'll see one in Greenland, right in the middle of Greenland. And you find one way up the Amazon, that's the lower left, and you see them in the Sahara. The air delivered them to places where they were living was almost impossible for humanity at that time. I had one in Alaska, et cetera, and so forth. So I then, with these able to be installed at strategic points, I saw then we could have the reasonable expectancy of length of flights for that time to make possible to have airlines. Then I showed on the map, if you begin to look quite carefully, you'll see little airplanes flying around. There's one right over Dakar, and there's one crossing the South Atlantic between South America and the Sahara, between Dakar. That flight came in. And at the time I did this, and then if you study this map, and it's been published elsewhere, you can find the Dymaxian world and so forth. The reproduction here is not sharp enough to be able to see it, and some of the corners have been cut. But the point is that you'll find on it the present major airlines were on here. Stephenson, who was a great Arctic explorer at that time, told me this. It was the first map of the world that he was aware of showing the flights of the Arctic. And this is a 1927 map. I also then call this the, down the bottom, if you read, I called it the one-town world. And I saw that if I could have my airlines and communication, then I could really begin to think about it as a one-town world. So this is really the beginning. Later on, I invented a term, Spaceship Earth. I did that at the University of Michigan in 1951. In a lecture then, and published it a little time later. But I've been trying very hard at all times to get society that I talk to think about the whole of that plan, always thinking planetary planning. And so now we begin to bring together geoscopes, seeing the whole Earth, seeing and feeling those resources, thinking about how we integrate taken the information you and I have as of this moment, and we have some very extraordinary information at this moment. Things we really can put those satellites there. We can do some incredible things. And we'd better start doing them. Said we have a very, very, we're in a very bad moment of the, I'm going to reiterate, I've said this to you before, but the psychological warfare between the great powers who are really going to run the earth, and the working assumption of psychologists has to, the great ideologist has to be you and me. There's no question about things have been done to try to make America break down, lose its confidence in itself, and to look askance on technology, and really, in fact, they hate anything and everything. Is it a possible salvation? So I'd like you to be sure to consider that and get yourself house cleaned, get right to. But I'm going to talk a good deal about my feeling about the great mysteries and God and so forth. Let's really get onto God and really start talking straight the truth. What is it all about? Now, I'd like to show you, there's a little footage of a moving picture footage about dealing with airlift, and I'd like to have that come on. This is on the aircraft carrier, I think it's the Ticonderoga. And that's the elevator coming up through the flight deck. This was done on my birthday, July the 12th. And look at the tensions it's taking up there on a. And they take her up and with that nice skin. This is a 55 footer that's put together in the 100, and watch it flying. They fly that at 65 knots. That's full hurricane, and looks just great.
How heavy?
That one is 1,400 pounds. It's a magnesium frame. 55 footer. Look at her trailing there. That's at full 65 knots now. She's really out, pretty horizontal. No yawing around, not doing anything like this. Very comfortable. Now, I'm going to come into some of the other early reductions to practice. And I'd like to go into the Dymaxian house again. I had the 10-deck building. And I thought I must get down to what the little individual's own dwelling would be, and this is all 1927 also. And so I'd like to go into some of the things of it. I said I must do with it. I like the idea of having a single compression mast, because I was a sailor, and that's fine. And then I knew then I could have tensions coming out at different sling angles. If you take the two suitcases like this, it's really quite comfortable. The more you try to go out horizontally, the worse the strain, but also the more tautly it gets, so that I saw I could have a tensionally supported compression rings, like a wire wheel. If I took a wire wheel, turned over and inside, let the hub of the wire wheel be the mass, just extended, so then I'd have tension coming out here to the compression ring. So it was my first tense segregity idea, where I then had discontinuous compression, continuous tension. But I wanted to use gravity all the way through. So I think you better remove my figure from in front of this. And you see the mast itself there, and that mast, this is really, I don't think my arrangement of my picture is right, because I had it without the mast on it. There are tension cables from the top of that mast to the six corners of the hexagon you see flying there. It looks like a halo. And there's a crisscrossing so that they will not rotate around. And then there's a second set of tensions from the outer hexagon corners down to, you see, three booms hanging there. Those three booms hanging, they also, then the tension members come back from them down to the, they come down to the ground, and there's crisscrossing so they won't rotate. I went into the complete study of not just how to make a building, but all the manufacturing and so forth. The mass that you're looking at there, the top of it is transparent, and it is a sun machine. I'm counting on picking up the sunlight and distributing it through the house. You'll see below the translucent cone at the top, there are louvers, and that's where the air for the house is taken in. And just below that, there's a little fin, and then below that, you see some openings. And just inside of that, we have a single lighting source. But the lighting source and the heating source of the house are all the same. It's a solar system. And the little solar system, I'm going to bring the big solar system in through the mass whenever it's available to build its energies and heat and light into the house. But also that I found enormous amounts of heat coming from my electric light, so I might as well combine the two. And so that there's a central lighting there, and then I had open hollow ceilings. They're prefabricated, and the end, they're triangular form and hollow, and the end comes up to those openings in the mass where the light came in, and I have central shuttering so that you can make any color light over the central light, so your whole ceiling was translucent and was a reflector, so that the light from the central source then was reflected through this translucent ceiling at any color you want and any magnitude. And you just simply shudder how much you like let in and not let in. But then the heat from the central source also came through holes in the perforated translucent ceiling, and there was air drawn out around the floor so that the air, whatever temperature was, would be drawn down to you rather than letting it keep pooling upwardly. And we had then also the windmill for the top of the house, so that you're going to use your windmill power to pull air over preferred circuits. Now, the mass then was pre-assembled with all this equipment in it, very much like assembling an airplane or an automobile, so that it was a sort of caisson, and it was my prime. Then all the other things folded up into pretty small packages. May I have the next picture? I'm really quite sorry, because I think there was a picture before that earlier that showed the packing crates. I had designed all my packing crates, and everything was going for all the shipping. I must be utterly responsible. And see if you can't find an earlier picture in there showing those packing crates with the mast standing. There it is. There's the mast and the septic tank base. Then you'll see just to the left of the base of the mast, these ceiling pieces that are hollow ceiling pieces made out of aluminum. Then you'll see the middle, lower left, wooden packing cases, and in those are all the space dividers. I said, we don't want a partition just as you shan't pass. I only want to have something that stops you where you really have some machine that's going to serve you there anyway. It would be like a tree is going to serve you, so you come to a tree, that's fine. But these must be very natural stoppings. And then between the ends of these pieces of machinery, you will have pneumatic sliding doors, and that I said you'll have always use a light cell to move it. You must get out hands. I found one where the greatest disease transfer is on doorknobs and so forth, so that I want to get rid of those things. And so the packing cases that do contain, for instance, their coat closets. And the coat closets had vertical hanging, the hemispherical coat hanger that comes out into the room on the door rotates. And so half of the space has a half circle and a ring, and you have all the clothing hanging from that. I've seen clothing stores that nowadays, but there was not such a thing. Then there was a shoe rack that went around just hanging without the clothes. And then the things that are horizontal, I had shelves that were mounted on cables that part of Neustadt and went up, and the shelves then could come to exactly the height where the opening, where the children couldn't get in there until they were the right age, where you could reach up and get things out. You just press a button, watch things go by, bookshelf, whatever it is, and take out what you want. It's not so that those are the kind of things. And I had my prefabricated bathroom. Just please remember, this is 1927, and we did get into, there's no such thing as home dishwashing or home laundries and things like that at the time. No, there's anything such thing as home air conditioning. But I'm really did bring in all that technology, and very much from the ship, just from the submarine and so forth. I'd have to do that. So all the parts of the house are lying there. Next picture. So then, now that mast was up, as I showed you already, and then the six compression struts, there were three that were hung from the ones above, now three more have been inserted. And because they're being pulled in like this, they stay in the compression ring very neatly. Then there's some tension plates that have been slung where the floors are going to be. Next picture. Then the first floor decking has been put in on top of the slings, and then the space dividing machinery has all been installed. And so you can see doorways there. And we're looking at the present time in a bedroom. There are two bedrooms, and this was approximately 40 feet diameter. I did on a metric systems at the time, because I wanted to get metric drawings in such an industry. But you're looking at one of the two bedrooms, and you can see those opening in the wall where the closet, the shelves come to. And then there was a large utility room, which you could call kitchen, but also the washing machines were in there. And so coming through that wall from that was a stove and ice box things where you could get things into the living room out of the far side of it for the table. The living room was a diamond shaped one. It was approximately 40 feet diagonal corner to corner. It was a big room. And then there was a library. Then down below we have the garage and hangars. Well, I have to put a light plane in there. Next picture. This is before those deck plates have been pulled tight. This is they're not quite the right order. Next picture. Now the second floor has been put in, and those ceiling pieces that do the reflecting of the light from the central mast have been put in place. They also deliver the air. They're plenary chambers for the air and the light into the various rooms. You've seen a reflection on the floor of the little room towards you. There's a lady lying naked on the bed there, because it's all air-conditioned, and so she would not necessarily need very much clothing. She could make the warm air come to her any way she wanted. But you can see the reflection of the light from the ceiling there on the floor. As I told you, the light is now operative in the center of that thing. And next picture. Then they put on the top floor deck for the roof, John. Next picture. Then the railings put in for that. Next picture. And then the canopy. Now that top deck, again, was very large, and it has central drainage, so any rain that comes in over beyond the roof there comes to the center, and we can't tap back into the system. So it catches all the rain or anything that lands on the building. You can see the translucent light at the center. Then I said, if you have opaque walls, it's very difficult to let light through them. They can cut a window through, but that takes a lot, it's very expensive. What I can do is have transparent walls, and then I can just shutter them, which is the way nature really does with your eyes, shutter very delicate membranes. When you get down to only reason for our wanting, we have something called privacy, and that's all there are four kinds of privacy. The olfactory privacy, there's tactile privacy, there's oral privacy, and there's visual privacy. These are the only senses we have, therefore, if I can't smell you, I've got olfactory privacy. If I can't touch you, I've got tactile privacy. If I can't hear you, I've got oral. But if I can't see you, then I've got visual. So I saw that it really takes a very delicate membrane for not seeing. And I noticed in garden parties and outdoors, the acoustical absorptions are so good by the grass and the bushes over. Group talking over there, you can't hear them over here. Really quite a short distance away, the acoustics so good. So if we can get in the right acoustics operating here, we don't have to get to two very great distances. But we then have this occulting or cutting off of the line of vision. So you see in the lower left part of the house, the window there, a triangular. So they had little aluminum roller screens that pulled over roller under the floor, and they came up vertically like a camera shot, and another one coming down until the two came together. So they went up, and they're like teeth coming together here. And found I could then give you all the opaquing you wanted, but when you did want to see out, you got a complete seeing out. Now, next picture, please. I'd like to be out of the picture. Now, this is one that I did for, at 1927, the Russian Revolution had been going on for, 10 years. And they were having mobile farming operations. We have mobile farming operations today, but they had then enormous cooperatives that moved along to do things. And I learned so much from this dome, this mass principle. I said I could make a tripod base, and a mass coming from the tripod with tension is very stable mass, and some good staking down deeply to that, and have great stability, and then I could hang up a structure around it that would make very possible that truck that you see over there is carrying. You see, I thought it would be possible to develop a really pretty first-class mobile dormitory for mobile farm operating teams, and that's what you're looking at there. I published it in Sheldon magazine in 1930. Yes. Next picture. There. You can see the dormitory things, and there's a central area and a whole lot of living around it. And I used an airplane wing type, with a foil, very strong, overlapping the horizontal for the closure. And that they could be trucked really very, very, very effectively, relatively lightly. Next picture. Looking there, I have a mast. This is the first one I ever made. I made an aluminum mast of three parts. And then I ran my tensions out to a horizontal compression ring of separate tubes with a little universal joint, and then having tension members triangulate this way and triangulate this way. So this was my first wheel, and then it came back to the base again, but it made a sort of a double wire wheel, but it was my first tensegrity. I want to understand, I've been thinking, feeling tensegrity longer before I got to identify it with my energetic geometry, and had really been able to use it quite effectively in the first time in house. I say this thing because I feel tremendously tender about Ken Snelson, a very extraordinary, beautiful artist. He was a real catalyst, and really changed it completely. My realization of how I really use that my energetic geometry. I've been wanting the tensegrity, but he gave me all the key, and so I feel very greatly indebted to him. But he's gone on as an artist, and I think that. I know Ken terribly well. There are times when people say, "Oh, Bucky is stealing yours," things and so forth. He doesn't think so anymore. He really appreciates it with me, but I'm sure I've never talked to him secretly without everybody knowing the part this boy played in this victory. Next picture. Give you an idea of what I looked like in 1928. This is a map of the drawing of the Dimaxian house turned sideways, kind of projected, mean easier to see the things that way. And you'll see the two prefabricated bathrooms at the center of the around the mast. And I had in the mast, I have an elevator. And the elevator was in a triangular shaft, and it was a tetrahedron itself, so there was no way it could fall out. You can understand it. It was triangular this way, and then it was coming down to the track. There's no way it could cock in the shaft. So it was a very safe thing, and then I found it really quite easy to actually screw yourself up, and if you wanted to do that, that seemed to me to be a very, very, very useful way to carry on. I also had the center of it. Also, I did have slide down shafts where you're having firehouse, which seemed to me to be very, very, very desirable way to get out of your house. Here, and this whole thing came out 3.5 tons. And when I did produce the actual first of the Dymaxion houses at the Beach aircraft, and I really followed the same mass principles at all, it came out 3 tons. That was 1943 from 1927. So it was a beautiful vindication of the calculations of 1927. The weights had come out all right. Next picture, please. If it brought me out here, I'm very, very proud of this picture because it is a watercolor done by my wife of the Dymaxion house in those years. And we've now been married. We're married in 1917, so we've been married 58 years now. And her support through these years was just incredible because she did not really understand precession and so forth. And I said, I'm not going to earn a living. You said, a beautiful new child was born after going, what had been through, because we almost, due to the enormous pain, she went to look out for her, being oldest attention, she really stayed with her family. We were almost apart while I was living all around the country, working on these houses, and almost separating us, and suddenly this new child. And so, but she would go along with me in the experiments, extraordinary faith in that I had something. That's what she just felt about it, apparently. Then, at the time in 1927, when she made this painting of the house, the models that had been made and I'm talking about, she felt it ought to have be seen in some kind of a proper setting. So she made this lovely rendering. And my brother, who was an engineer, 3 years younger than I am, a really very beautiful boy. He died 15 years ago, but he was very, very fond of me, but he also didn't like what to him seemed to be a lot of dreaming, and he felt that I got a lot of trouble, and he thought I kidded myself a great deal. And he was incredibly precise, I think, simply because he was worried about me, even when I was ready to be more meticulous in the way he said anything. The year that this happened, I got a telegram from him in the Pittsfield where he'd gone to work for General Electric. And he telegraphed to me saying, I'm engaged to be married to the most wonderful girl in Pittsfield, as other people said in the world, but he can only check out Pittsfield. This would be typical of my brother. And so he was shocked. Very, very badly, because I said I was going to wave my hands and open the doors in the Dymaxion house, and there's no way to do such stuff. Absolutely nothing. And not long after this, I got a telegram, and he didn't say thank God, but he indicated that. He said, we've discovered and developed the photoelectric cell here, and you can get one of these for $72. So. That I was vindicated about waving a hand and not having doorknobs. He wrote time and again, say, Bucky, would you please tell me what this Dymaxion house is all about? And I would tell him what it's all about, and then he would write back. And finally, my wife saw that I really was quite put out, because he said, I wish you'd stop all that philosophy and just tell me what it's all about. And so Anne wrote a letter to him that we have, and if any of you get that little reprint of 4D, which we have a record of, a letter is in there, I think, which he explained to my brother what it was that I was up to. But this is the only real proof I have that Anne really, she really didn't know what I was talking about. I think that such principles that you could not have to earn a living, things like that, she didn't discuss that part, but she just simply said that she knew that I said I was passionately committed, that I really, really was convinced I knew what I was doing. She says that, but it's very important that we've been able to, we've lived through a great deal together, and she's a I think she's born in January and I was born in July, and every way we pose like that, and as I say, where you're so really different that if you really can get on, then it's really great. but it's very productive because we are so different. And I don't want to have any such meetings we're having here without having you all know how moved I am, but back in time. I have the next picture. We've really seen that before. Next picture. Now we're coming to development of the Dymaxion cars, because underneath my house I had a Dymaxion vehicle, and I was planning to deliver it by air, therefore it could be delivered to very remote places. And yet it had to have its own autonomous equipment so it would operate where you got to. So it didn't have to have its methane tanks, and it did have to generate its own energy and gas, and did have to use the local wind and sun and so forth. But if you're going to deliver it by air, then there'd be no roadway to get there. Therefore, I'd have to have some kind of a vehicle that would get me there and make spot landings where a bird can land without prepared landing fields and so forth. I'd have to have something that could go possibly overland if I could. If I could go on the highway, it would be fine. I also had to be able to go by air and water. So I wanted to develop an amphibious kind of a vehicle. If you could remove my face from front of the screen, because I like to be able to look at what you're looking at here. I then went through the following thoughts, and what I'm going to talk to you about, good many things have happened, and really happened quite beautifully. I want you to remember, I was in the Navy, and I was also involved with the early flying of the Navy. And Pat Ballinger, who was commander of my first operation down in the Navy, I was in charge of all the boats that were patrolling and looking out for the first of the naval aviators who were practicing at Hampton Roads, and where we had our main naval air base station. And we were losing an aviator a day, where these single pontoon or other boats, where they were tripping, and the aviator belted in would be his head down in the water, ship upside down. And I developed a way of developing very fast boats that had a boom to grapple and pull it up out of the air, look, so the water can be out, so everybody can get underneath and get him out. And that's what got me sent to Naval Academy. Well, the Pat Ballinger, who was in command of that operation there, was one of this Navy Naval Academy, was one of the first four flyers of the United States Navy. And later on, he was one of the great admirals. And Ballinger, now I talked a great deal about propulsion for the airplane, and he would like very much to have seen a turbine, and he was very interested in my idea of using liquid oxygen to produce them very enormous pressures of air, as you did. One single drop of liquid oxygen expanded in a pre-expansion chamber would give you extraordinary pressures and make turbines operate very, very powerfully. But they'd be cold. He wanted something that was not subject to the freezing, because if you got in the sky, in those days, had a lot of trouble about freezing. We had many water-cooled engines, and as we went up, you'd get up and put rags on as we got in, getting colder, so getting great altitude, stand out in the cockpit and put rags on the radiator so it wouldn't get too cold. Lots of problems about the freezing and going up out 45 degrees. So he was very eager to get into, and he liked the steam, but that would get you into freezable waters and so forth. So the idea of the liquid oxygen, he thought, was very good. And I did get into radial of inventing and thinking about liquid oxygen propulsion in 1917. And so, coming back then to a vehicle that would get you from here to there, where there'd be no prepared landings and no highways, and might just be able to come by now, but you might be able to come in by water, you might be able to come by a highway some other time. Omni-medium vehicle. And I saw that
There are two kinds of fundamental flying. There is the soaring bird, the gull, but there's also the faster flying bird, the duck. And the duck cannot soar. It has really very small wings. And I saw that what happens with the duck is that, first place I'm going to point out that everything in the universe is in motion, and everything in the universe in motion is moving in the directions of least resistance. I saw it is possible then to improve the directions of a preferred a direction you'd like things to go by making it easier to go in that direction. This is something quite different from the propulsion. So the shape you gave to a boat or an airplane is very important in relation to it. It's having a preferred direction, and you can control that preferred direction and go in that direction the easiest way. So I saw that birds are fantastic, beautifully streamlined that way, and the ship and the fish are beautifully designed in this preferred direction. A lot of things you may not have thought of having that, I saw it did have. That's, for instance, I want you to think about a carrot or various single fruits come falling from a tree, and it's very necessary to get the seed a little deep. If you look at the very shape of the seed itself, it is streamlined to go in a preferred direction. And the apple drops it in such a way that those seeds get definitely aimed, it splatters, and the aim of those seeds in the right direction. So with frost, they'll keep working down into the earth. You find many of these things, the tubers and so forth, then are designed to streamline the carrot, streamline to come out at the right time. It moves out of the ground and suddenly it breaks away its little hair roots, like letting bloom go, and then it streamlines and comes right out. So nature uses an enormous amount of preferred direction streamlining. So I said, I'm going to think then about how this duck flies. I find what the duck does. As you know, just you can build up momentum, as I give you this, a hammer thrower. So the same way, a pole vaulter can then, with his pole, incidentally, a naked man, who's a good athlete, can high jump to a little bit over the height of the man. But the same man with a pole, making him weigh more than this naked man, can then start running towards his bar and using his momentum, putting the pole in the ground, then it carries him up where he goes and jumps sometimes three times the height of a man. So seemingly he's been weighted. With the pole, he weighs more than he did when he was going to just high jump by himself. So, but he makes up for that by running and building energy into the situation as a momentum. So he, with the momentum, he's going to go in this direction. I saw then he got up and then he, supposing you gave, as he went over the bar, you had another bar waiting there because he has a motion going this way, then he keeps going along, might go along on one pole after another quite a way. And that's with tip, and then you grab another one and keep on going. So you might carry that momentum quite a long way. Now, I saw that what happened with a duck is the duck starts running on the water, literally running on the water, really running very hard. It gets up on the surface and scooping its feet right along like that, beautifully. And meantime, flapping its wings very hard. It builds up enough momentum forwardly, and the streamlining is so superb, the direction of least resistance is going really fast, and suddenly where a little bit of air like this, like the pole vault, gives him a little vertical, right? And then in this little vertical ascension, he now then falls in the direction of least resistance. So he leans his head a little more like this, but another thump. So keep giving yourself a new pole vault, and he keeps falling in the direction of least resistance. So you watch the duck coming on, he's continually falling and getting new and falling. And gradually builds it up in a little more altitude. Anybody who is a flyer knows that since you're just taking off the aircraft carrier, the first thing you do is to nose down towards the water and build up a little more speed, like that gravity would help you. So you're getting off, you always do this. So the duck is continually using gravity to accelerate him a little more, having gotten an altitude. And the gravity is pulling on him, but he has a direction of least resistance and enormous forward momentum. Therefore, see, he said the gravity is going to help to pull him this way. So he keeps building that up. So I saw that when the duck came in for landing, as he finally got up to good out at a good speed, he now no longer has to have rather vertical, these are what they call air stilts, jet stilts. These are jets. He propels jumps, he really propels the water, the air out under his wing, like I said, jet. So he has two jets, and those jets are controllable in that direction. So they start off quite vertical, then as he gets building up his speed, he begins going backward a little more, so that begins to push him forward at the same time. And he finally gets to where he builds up a little lift on his own head and his back, because he's designed also that way, so a little longer distance air over the top of him. So he actually begins to build up lift. They do that, incidentally, the blimp fire. The people who fly these rather slow balloon, then they can put an attitude and begin to give lift on it, and then they can really get much more forward out of it. So I saw then that the designing of this duck indicated that you might be able to develop a vehicle without any wings, because the duck was not using wings for soaring. That's the only reason we had wings on the airplane. It really is a soaring device. And so I said, I'm going to divide. If you do that, then the vehicle weighs very much less. In order to have wings, you have to have very powerful spars, and the weight of the airplane is very greatly increased over what it would have to be if it didn't have wings. Therefore, I could have a vehicle weighing very, very little, superbly streamlined, which would then have what I call twin jet stilts. And they're twin controllable angle jet stilts, so that I could start off then running forwardly and then giving myself a little jet. But that jet would be a turbine jet, so that it would be more or less of a continuous jet effect. And I was planning on using the liquid hydrogen for my propulsion here, so that your vehicle would have wheels, and you could run along on the ground, build up, and then you suddenly open up the vertical, so give you some altitude, and the angle of the you'd have two jet stilts, and you'd have them going a little bit outwardly like that, so they converge above you here, above your center of gravity. And the third pole would be the falling pole. Gravity makes the third leg, because then you've got your direction, you've got your momentum to stabilize that. So I'm going to come back to another experience you have. Have you ever done stilt walking, stilts? Now here you've got, I gave you two, remember, two poles standing up, and they would could go anywhere, but the two of them got together, and then suddenly they could only act like a hinge. So on stilts, they're on a hinge. So you really only got two ways you could fall, backwards or forwards here. So you start to fall a little forward, and then just move the stilt forward, and makes the third leg, and it stops you there. So now you got a new hinge, and you hinge this way. So you start to go that way, and then move this one over here, and it stops you falling that direction. So there's this little delicate falling forward, and this ability to change to the third compression member, and that's always initiatable. So I saw in the same kind of a way then as that, my twin jet stilts, first giving you verticality and then building up the momentum forward and getting out flatter and flatter. Then when you want to come in for landing, you can do this, but your jet stilts can be quite wide if you want to have your hinge wide or narrow, and all these would converge above you, so you'd be hanging from it. If you're on top of it, it'd be top heavy, but the convergence of the vectors must be above you. And right, this is my theory of what I call then the Dymaxion vehicle, and I called it the Omni-Medium Twin Jets Orientable Stilts vehicle. Transport. So, obviously, I was not going to be able to get that kind of equipment right away, but I'm quite confident you're going to see what I've given you, because in the years that happened since that, suddenly we did come. When I talked this way in the 27, and came a chance in 19. The picture you saw of some little vehicles there. May I come back to that same picture, the first picture in this group? Here you'll see some of those vehicles. They are, you see them on water. There's an entry. It's a V-bottom and you see the two points of contact, and these are pictures of my vehicle going through the sky. Those models, I had drawings of them, and Noguchi, who was a great sculptor friend of mine, made me some very nice clay models, and then we made them in plaster and colored them. And the New York Automobile Show, the year before the episode I told you about of Chrysler, was this is when the New Deal came in, everything was absolutely stopped, and they had the hall all hired, and very few people put any automobiles over there, but they'd seen my models in an engineering bookshop on Park Avenue, and they asked me if I'd come to the show, and I did, and I had a booth and talked to, described what the models would do, what I hoped the models would do, what the theories were. I had very many very interesting conversations, one with Bill Stout, who was the man who designed the first Ford tri-motor airplane. And Bill Stout later on then was, he was president of the American Association, the Automobile Designing Group, Society of Automotive Engineers, SAE. And he wrote a very beautiful article about my vehicle and vehicle theories for their magazine. And then Bill later on built what was called the Scarab Car in Detroit, a couple of years after I did the Dymaxion vehicle. Now, when I did this Dymaxion vehicle, as a consequence of the automobile show, and then the real things, the crash, things were really settling down economically, and somebody said, I would like to back you, Bucky, you have a whole lot of ideas, and I really like to see some things. The depression was completely on, and somebody who has some money said, you might just well have some the money I have, because it seems to be everything just going away anyway, and maybe something you could to develop would be worthwhile. So I wrote a little simple, very simple contract. I said, if you let me, I can spend it all on ice cream sodas if I want. Then I'll take the money, but it must not say what's going to do. It's not for profit, and that kind of. And that turned out to be a very good contract later on. Because after things began to go, then everybody thought this person ought to make a lot of money and so forth. But we did not go into the pension. I was not trying to go in. I just can't get anywhere if you're going out to do things for profit. I learned that in the housing world. So I went then to Bridgeport, Connecticut, where I went to Bridgeport, Connecticut, the day that Franklin Roosevelt declared the bank moratorium. It was just the day of his inauguration. And this person had given me money several weeks before, and I turned it all into cash. And luckily I had turned it all into cash, because then the bank moratorium, there's no money anywhere. And I arrived in Bridgeport, Connecticut, the only person in town, not only money, but my pocket's full of it. And I went from being the most ineffective character that ever happened to suddenly being very effective. And everybody wanted to work for me. So everything shut down, nobody had any jobs, and I got part of the old, this is my building, in due course, I got the old dynamometer building of the old locomobile automobile, which was a very great automobile in its day. And they'd gone absolutely bust, and the banks owned them, so they rented me this building, which had been the dynamometer building, and it was out on a point of land in the harbor, a very nice point. And in there, I produced the three Dymaxion cars. Also up in the front of it, you'll see a boat upside down. And I got Starling Bridges, who was a very great aeronautical ship designer, but also an aeronautical designer, to come to along with me as my engineer. A very extraordinary man, Starling. Starling, to anybody in the sailing world, knows all about it, but not so many other people do know of him. He did with a man named Dunn, who was a very great scientist in England, James Dunn, developed the Bridges-Dunn airplane for the United States Navy in 1912, and it was the first hands-off landing ship, and it was the first Delta Wing. As the Delta Wing came in many years later, suddenly went back, found the Bridges-Dunn thing was it. But It was a plane where the pilot could literally take his hands off, and it could land the seaplane without any trouble at all, self-landing. And then Starling designed, he was there, if you know, in the yachting world, there were the 6 meters and 8 meters and the 10 meters and the 12 meters, very well known. The 12 meters usually in that. He invented all those classes of sailing boats and designed the best of them. He also designed the last three great J boats after World War II. The cost of boat building so went up that you had to race the 12 meters, which were pretty small boats. But the last of the great big boats were the J boats. Starling designed all three of those. Before him, his father, Edward Burgess, had designed three American Successor Cup Defenders. It was very much a family tradition. He designed the Puritan, the Volunteer, and the Mayflower, and they all beat the English. And Starling Burgess's brother was the chief mathematician for the United States Navy's lighter-than-air structures, that's all their zeppelins and things. He's a very extraordinary mathematician, extraordinary kind of a family. Starling himself was very much a mathematician and a very eccentric man. He'd gone to the same school I had, Milton Academy, quite a few years before me, and he was terribly interested in my ideas and Dymaxion House and all, and he was very eager to work with me on developing my vehicle. Because I said, I don't have enough money being given to me to produce a Dymaxion House. That would cost $30 million. I'd gone into that very clearly. Furthermore, I said, I cannot possibly develop the new propulsion means. Therefore, what I will do, because the automobile world is producing all kinds of equipment that I can use, I can test the ground taxing qualities of my omni-medium transport, because the most dangerous phase of flying or shipping is when you hit the land, when you hit a rock, or when you contact with the crystalline, because in the air you're in a low distributing element. And once you launch your beautiful ship in the sea, all the loads are beautiful, hydraulically, pneumatically distributed. It's terribly safe, so you get a concentrated load of a rock or a pier or another ship. So the most dangerous condition of flying is when you make contact with Earth. I saw that with a completely streamlined vehicle, when I got on the Earth, because if you are a flyer of a light plane, you know that she immediately, as you land, is a crosswind, she wants to head in the wind. And the airplanes used to have a great deal of ground looping, it's called, and this very violent swinging around, maybe turned upside down, really often crack up a ship just after landing with a crosswind. So I said, with the kind of streamlining I'm going to get into, the fairing has to be absolutely superb. Therefore, she'll want to head into the wind. So if I'm going to, on the highway, I can't control the wind, so her ground taxiing is going to be, how is she going to maneuver? What's going to happen? So I built this vehicle to test the ground taxing qualities of an eventual omni-medium transport. I did not go into designing an automobile, but here it was running on the ground. I had to get a license from the state to be allowed to take it out on the highway, so that everybody called it the Dymaxion automobile. And many people incidentally said to me, after I built three of these, "I'm sorry your car wasn't a success." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you didn't get a production." I said, "I wasn't going into the business, I was producing a vehicle." And it was extremely successful. I learned an incredible amount. And it actually did affect the whole automotive world. They did learn many, many things from that car, I assure you. And it did change many of the grand strategies of automotive engineering. Now, it was an interesting vehicle in that it also, like the bird, or the fish, and so forth, the propulsion is up forward, abreast of the center of volume, the center of gravity, and so forth, and the steering is in the rear. That's where a bird, that's where nature does its trick. She doesn't have the fish with its tail out in front of her, does she? And seems to be nothing more stupid than trying to jump overboard and push the bow of the Queen Mary around. And what you do, because the rudder really uses low pressures and so forth. It's a beautiful thing to pull the ship around. So I felt anyway, the way to do it is to do what I said. It has to be front traction, tractor, and rear steering. So it's the first vehicle of its kind that I know of that did that, and the only one other thing I've seen like that, which has been actually a road cleaner, very slow road thing, which can turn around pretty easily, sweeping the gutters. Now, tell you some more. I'd like to get the sort of fundamentals of what's going on here. You have a wheelbarrow, and how many of you pushed a wheelbarrow? Let me see hands. It's a fairly common experience, right? Have you ever been pushing a wheelbarrow quite fast in a field and suddenly hit something, hopefully in the stomach? Okay. If you put it behind you, that doesn't happen. It doesn't fast you out over any open field because you're pushing it down into the ground. That's your force. And if you get a bad bump, it's just going to stop there. But if you're pulling it, you're lifting it off the ground. You pull it over the humps. So I said, if I pull my steering wheel, it's not going to skid. If I'm pushing it down, all the cars we have are front steered. The weight, they literally are being pushed down to the ground. And that's why the racing steering all has to skid all of its sins. It does not steer around at all. It's a stupid way to have to steer, to skid. So all real racing, it just matters how much angle of skid you're really doing. Now, once you're in the skid, you really have lost basic control. It's really a flying machine now, which is good. So it is very important not to get in the skid if you want to really keep control. So I'm having a front tractor and I'm pulling my steering wheel. And I assure you, it behaved incredibly beautifully. Furthermore now, the front steered car, due to the kingpins and so forth, it can only get up to 34 degrees of angle before it blocks itself. And I saw that many times I'd like to turn much more sharp, going very slow, no reason for not getting much more of an angle. So with my rear steer, I could then have a rudder post, a vertical rudder post, and single wheel, and I could really give it any angle I wanted. Didn't run into blockings with the frame at all. So we had a main frame, which was supported on the front wheels and long undersprung wheel springs in front. Automobiles have short springs in front and long in the rear. I found what happened with that was that when you go over a bump, you get a little, and the second one throws you off the ground. I found you have the long springs in the front and the short in the rear. You go over the first ones and the other ones contracting as you're going over. Simply compounds your seat downwardly. And the dynamics, you just sat down in the seat twice. Not going off the seat at all. It's a very, very comfortable feeling. Now, these are the things I really needed to try out. And picture, I think it'd be a good idea to get me out of the way of this frame. Looking at the frame of that car, I want you to notice all lightning holes. After World War II, the Italians began to build their racing cars because in building a structure, as you learn in aeronautics, if you make a lightning holes, and they said what they call dished lightning holes. You not only have the hole, but you push the hole through and you make the lip turn up to give it stiffness around the edge of the hole. These are dished lightning holes. You can take 25% of the weight out of the structure without relieving your strength. So this is very worthwhile on the web. Then we had lightning holes in my framing. I had it. My framing was made of chrome aluminum steel. That's aircraft steel, not the mild steel of automobiles. This is very beautiful work of art. And you're just looking at the front end of the vehicle. The body's going to be mounted on that. So that after that base frame, which is pretty well balanced over the front wheels with a long spring, then we came to what are called an A-frame. And the A-frame, there were trunnions in the rear end of the base frame. The engine was in the rear end of the base frame. And therefore, being on the base frame, it was directly connected to the banjo gear in the drive shaft, and simply the engine then rotated around the front drive shaft, but but was the only spring was in that way. And then there were this A-frame. Here's the engine mounted here. Here's the wheels up here, and here's the frame. Now this trunnion is A-frame, and then from the A-frame there was a cross spring at the end of the base frame, and we had two hangers from the A-frame, which is hinge, down to the ends of those springs, so that the engine was hung, was sprung, all right, in this long hinging frame. The whole frame itself would bend in its own part like this. It was a hinge. The frame was a hinge, and this had a spring to keep from doing that. So that it was. Then we had the body, was completely separate suspension, had its own springs mounted above this, and it had two short Rolls-Royce half circle springs back to the base frame, alongside where the nursery of the engine was. So you can look through a little window in the back seat of the car at the engine, and you can see that going up and down, pumping, or the A-frame going like that, not in any way bothering the inertia of the main body, which is on its own frame with its own long springs to the front wheel. And simply a matter of the secondary spring between the body and the... And it allowed these things to do anything without really carrying anything through into the body itself at all. So it would keep the body from tipping too far, tipping forward, because we were overhanging the front axle by quite a lot. The system worked incredibly, really beautifully well. I've never had any ride in history that even mildly touches any kind of vehicle. May I have some more pictures of the car besides those nice frame pictures? You see the two front lights are mounted. This is the very first chassis we made. Starling Burgess is sitting up far there in his flying hat and the coon coat from the days of the airplanes when the coon coats were being worn. And we were trying out our very first chassis. You see the radiator of the engine in the back there. That's the drive wheels. Here's the bow of the ship. Here's the first, the main drive wheels, and you can't see the rear steering back here, but here's where the engine is. And that's where the radiator was inside the body, and we scooped the air in underneath the car to go through the radiator. Next picture, please. This is the first vehicle we turned out. We built three of them. It was an all aluminum body, and I did use this is crystal. Was just a celluloid, a crystalloid they called it at the time. And the rear cabin. I had on a little window top, and I had a periscope so that you could look over the whole car, and you could see anybody standing beside the car back with your tail. It was a beautiful thing. And this one had a scoop for air to go into the ventilator there, and the engine's the rear, and you just open the back door there, and you've got the engine on a beautiful workbench. It's very, very convenient. You lift that rear bustle to get at your rear wheel if you want to change anything there. Now, next picture, please. Then these are some of the drawings for the second and the third cars. I built three of them successfully each time, trying to prove how much you learn. Next picture. The next picture again. This is very interesting, the cars now. Once you look at the top, I have a car, the regular four-wheel car, wanting to get into the parking lot. He has to go ahead of position and back in, and it takes him quite a lot of room to get in there. I always could come in head on, and because my rear steering could go over up to 90 degrees if I wanted, I simply go sideways. So I had a round nose, and I just bring my round nose, the window frame, right up to the where that was in front of me there, and then she'll just rotate in place and never advance anymore at all. Just saw your wheel sideways. It's a lovely thing. But used to it. The newsreel movie pictures used to love it because they would give me 3 inches more than the length of my car, and I was coming down the street fast and going like that, and no trouble at all. because such a perfect control there. As long as I knew the 3 inches were there, I didn't really dare throw my tail over, because all I did was really watch my front window frame and then the car in front of me. She did all kinds of things in these beautiful ways, and I had center gravity of the car nearer the front axle than the rear. All our automobiles have always been nearer the rear axle. So I'm really changing the pattern very greatly. It meant then that the outboard wheel on a turn, the relationship between the center gravity of your car and the tire where it touches the ground, the outboard wheel turn, is the fulcrum of overturn. As you go around the turn, what stops you from going forward now is the tire itself, where it touches the ground, and the line of center of gravity of the car pushes at that. So if it's much higher than it, or very far behind, it tends to rotate over it. But I kept my center of gravity so low and so close to the front axle, it was really like a gun carriage. You couldn't tip it over. And while I was driving then, I simply kept my wheel accelerating, and therefore I didn't go into a skid, and I could give really very, very sharp turns. I began gradually practicing what I could do, and I would be able to. I finally found that I didn't want to do too fast, and I didn't want to have a tire ripped off its rim by the enormous weight of the car just stopping like that. I was able to slow down to 15 miles an hour. If I was 15, I could put her into a 180-degree turn and make a turn with the inboard wheel in the turn, making a circle 1 foot. I'd literally hook around and go the other direction. Now, there's no other vehicle in the world could do that, so that motorcycle policemen start after me, and I'm suddenly going the opposite direction, you can't do anything about it. And they got to be known all around, the motorcycle cops all around the country that did that, so they were bothering me to try to get me to do it. Anyway, there was one occasion when I was asked to, they were opening the first midget racing car track in New York up in the Bronx, and they asked me if I'd bring my car there as a feature for the opening night, and I did. They had me parked out in the middle of the oval and racing window, so they had an interval break, and they had all the officials got in my car. It would carry 11 passengers. So it's a big vehicle. It was 19 feet long. That's the length of the big Cadillac or the big cars of the day. But I got an incredible amount out of it. 11 passengers and getting really very high mileages and extraordinary efficiencies. So the car was loaded up with all the officials of the track, and they asked me to drive around the track just to show for the people. So I went. I was going around. I thought I might as well go fairly briskly. So I was going around my scene. In it, you really just set up like a church here. It's an extraordinary stability. So we went around, and I was just really going around quite comfortably, and I thought everybody enjoying themselves. And I said, "You've broken the track record by almost 50%. I went around, these kids, cars all skidding around and everything. I really just went around, going around like a church, standing up, no effort at all, and breaking the track record." Well, there were bugs in it, and you had to learn those. And number one were the crosswinds, and it really was something. She did want terribly to head into a crosswind, and gusty northwest wind day, crosswinds was something, because I had aircraft stainless steel flexible cables for my steering, because the front steering was up front, to a geared head on top of our rudder post back aft. So there was no slack in them whatsoever, going through beautiful ball-bearing shivs. The kinds of shivs you see on sailing boats today are getting to be very lovely kind of shivs on racing boats. Stanley Bridges was designed, we made all our shivs, we made everything like that, got the ball bearings and made some very extraordinary hardware. And he was, because he'd wanted to design those kind of things for the cup defenders and so forth, he already gotten into some very beautiful, he had already introduced extraordinary hardware into the nautical world, and he didn't think anything at all of getting our own hardware for this car. So crosswind, and what happened was that there was no slack in my steering at all, so the tire would distort. The wind tried to twist me really violently, and the tire, the rubber, the diaphragmatic tire would yield. So this could throw whips into you. I had to really learn to be very, on a very bad crosswind day, it's really like flying a plane. Really didn't have to learn to, really learned how to play that wind. So it was not something anybody could have right away, and I knew I'd have to improve those features now. And if I do build another one someday, I will know how to do it. I'll point out to you that nature has such problems, and there are one of the oldest creatures known to human beings are the horseshoe crab, this long tail, and they go back to the very earliest of the known creatures. Now their job, life, is to cross streams. They're in where the tidal streams and so forth. And they're designed to literally go cross-stream. And in hydraulics, there is no yielding that there is in the pneumatics. And so they have to be superbly designed to go cross-wind or to go cross-current. They designed them with a whole crescent tail. They have a broad nose, but they have a 120-degree crescent where the section through them goes up their nose and look, take a section back from the middle of the nose. Is it the same section through the whole 120 degrees? So there's no difference in the drag. Otherwise, you have to have a broad tail. I had a single tail, everything focusing down on that tail, and it nose right up into the wind. But by having the broad tail, you can do that. That crosshoe crab is then able to use his secondary tail to help a little on any sort of delicate balance in addition to that release. It can really make his tail go to increase the tendency to let go of the drag in that direction. So it can go across currents. And I found it would be just easy to do that. So later on, I was asked by Henry Kaiser to design a vehicle, and I did design it that way. And I designed that one with the rear steering wheel also on an extendable boom, because I found that when you're not going fast, I can really make very, very tight turns, really go right around in a circle here locally in the garage, really turn myself around and go out the other way. Right on the spot, but in a long boom you couldn't do that in a way, so that I could have an extensible boom, give me the long wheelbase on the highway, and automatically contract as you began to slow down and lengthen it at the speeds. Well, that is more or less enough here. Oh goodness, getting late. The Chicago World's Fair, we had two extraordinary events. One, a very, very untoward event. The opening of Chicago World's Fair in 1933. They had wanted to use my Dymaxion house, but I found it cost much too much. I wasn't willing to make just a mock-up. It had to be a real thing. So they made a mock-up. But in England, there was a man named his title was the Master of Semple. It's a Scotch title, and he was the greatest aviator in England in those days, and extraordinarily well thought of. When the Graf Zeppelin made a special first trip over to the Chicago World's Fair, and the Master Semple was invited as the English guest to go on the flight to America, to go to the World's Fair, and the Air Minister of France were on the trip. These two men telephoned me from the Graf Zeppelin over the Atlantic, asking if I could have the Dymaxion car available for them to see at Chicago at the fair. By this time, I let the car go to a man named Al Williams, who was the Navy's number one speed flyer, and left the Navy to become head of gasoline sales for the Gulf refining. And Al had acquired my first car for the Gulf Company to use at air meets, and it became the official car at air meets running around the airfield. And when this call came. I then got in touch with Al Williams. So he had a race driver take the car out to Chicago to meet these two distinguished guests. Then the car was put at the disposal with this race driver. During their visit, the Graf Zeppelin just dropped them off at Chicago and went back to Akron where it could be moored. The day came a few days later when the word came that the Graf Zeppelin is to return to England and these two guests would have to rejoin. Meantime, they'd driven the car a lot and they needed the car to get out to the Chicago airport in a hurry. They called in, so 7 o'clock in the morning, went to their hotel, picked the two men up and started out for the Chicago airport when there was, next thing I knew, there was a New York Times full headline, a freak car rolls over and kills race driver and famous dress, wounded and injured and so on. And I was in Bridgeport and the Associated Press got in touch with me when I was building my second car at the time. No, yes, I was just starting the drawing, I was doing on the drawings of the second car. And I flew out and I had an engineer friend in Chicago who asked him to go and start investigating as fast as he could. I telephoned him. And I flew out to Chicago and we found the car had been removed from this accident. It had occurred just in front of the main gate of the Chicago World's Fair. And so we found where the car was been put in a garage. We looked it over very carefully and couldn't find anything wrong with the steering gear it had rolled over. And you may remember my looking at it there, I said, this is Christian God and so forth. I had it a convertible and I had an open top with a buttoned on canvas top on here. So we could open it up. And it did, they had a, Al Williams as a flyer had put in and flying seat belts into it. And the driver had one of those on. The car had rolled over and the top had punched in and he had been killed. The air minister from France was sitting in the rear seat. He didn't have a belt on and this canvas top open. He went out and landed on his feet. The master Seppel was sitting beside the driver, had his head very badly and he was in the hospital in Chicago in a very critical condition. We went to the hospital and they let me listen to him there, so I wondered if it might say anything to give me any kind of clues what had happened. While I was standing waiting, the King of England called up. He was a very close friend of his and it became really very much an international matter. Imagine how I was feeling it. My car had killed one man, another extraordinarily injured. Master Semple did recover, thank God, and they had a coroner's inquest on account of the death of the driver. And the coroner's inquest postponed the meeting, hoping against the day that Master Seppel might recover because he'd been driving the car, was familiar with it all, and he might be able to tell him what happened. So it was postponed. 60 days later, they had the continued meeting, at which time the Master Sabo told about then that something happened to me very, very frequently. As they were coming, it was a 10-lane highway, 5 lanes on either side, and they had been in the outermost lane, and a car tried to rubberneck with them. People always wanted to look at me, and they tried to ride along beside you, and you're getting, it was a very torturous feeling that people are looking at you, and they're going to run into something. So he had accelerated, to get away from him and came in the second lane, and this man then started rubbing next door. He began really pestering, and so he finally got to the middle lane, and this man tried to go outside, and the man hit his tail and threw him out of steering. The precession, incidentally, when you do hit, it's a terrific precession thing. So the man who owned the other car was the South Park commissioner. Turned out later, and his car had been moved right away. My engineer friend and I had gone to see the policeman who was on the corner at the time it happened, and he didn't know anything about this thing at all. But later on, then, when it turned out that there had been a collision, not a freak rollover. 60 days afterwards, and so the coroner simply said, well, it was a mutual responsibility, some kind of carelessness, but it's no real fault of anybody. Anyway, it was not the car, but my car had got an enormous kind of a blow. Al Williams, as I said, had been one of the leading Navy flyers. He said, Bucky, your car is in no way responsible, so you've got a really great obligation to society, and that society is not, no, it isn't the car. We couldn't get hardly any publicity about it. There's no news of that guy. And anyway, so that's why I ducked car number two and car number three. Well, I had two underway, but that's why I ducked car number three to really clean things up. And I think I did wipe out pretty much of that stigma, but you can imagine how I felt. So the I would like to tell you a little more about back in that operation in this production. I said I arrived in Bridgeport, day of the Bank Moratorium, the country in absolutely stopped there, and we started them developing these cars. And in the end, I took on 28 mechanics, very extraordinary skilled men, or draftsmen, a total team of 28 in that little building there. And nobody had any jobs anywhere. There, for those 28 jobs, there were way over 1,000 applicants. And as I found I was going to need, I started my own machine shop, own woodworking shop, so forth. The Rolls-Royce company had opened up a American, they were going to produce Rolls-Royces in America at Hartford, Connecticut. The boom, enormous Wall Street boom just before the crash. So they curtailed that operation, but their men were still over in America. I got the two leading Rolls-Royce body workers to work for me there, extraordinary craftsmen. And right, a beautiful Italian machine tool man, beautiful Polish metal hammer workers and so forth, extraordinary team. Anyway, as I took on my crew and these applicants, nobody had eaten it. The families were really starving. And what I did then, when I got two equally good men, I found which who had the largest family, who hadn't eaten for the longest time, and I take him on. Every one of the 28 went into tears when I took him on. They're going to be able to go to the family. It was a terrific time, I assure you. Well, so remember, this is the first day of the new deal that I'm opening up there. Then later on, got the WPA going, so we got some jobs, and they got all kinds of inventing of jobs and so forth. Anyway, I found that when I was finishing my car, I really only had enough money to produce this one car. And as I got near it, and I explained to everybody, I was just going to build this one car. I wasn't going into business. I wasn't there to make a profit. I simply wanted to demonstrate a vehicle, see whether my principles were right. Because the dynamics of this were very critical. So they all understand that. They couldn't have been better craftsmen. They'd love the work. But as we got near the end of it, they realized this is the end of that job and my family. WPA hadn't made things right. It was only 6 months gone by, and they, without any conspiracy whatsoever, each one just sold out like that. I couldn't get my car finished. The only way I got car finished was to start car number two, and then everybody got the first car finished. we have here a moving picture of the launching of that first car. It just runs for a very short moment. I think it'd be a nice way to end this evening's session. Can we have that little show? That's Amelia Earhart standing there in the middle, and to her right is Kingsford Smith, who was through the Southern Cross, first across the Pacific. That's with the little model of my chassis of my car.
What scale model?
Amelia Earhart was a very, very great friend of mine. She just really loved my car. That model no longer exists. Immediately, that's Sir Charles Kingsford Smith. She received the gold medal of the National Geographic in Washington, and Mrs. Roosevelt asked her to come down and stay with her at the White House, and Mita said, "Bucky, if I'm going down there, that's Starling Bridges, by the way, and the older man by the tail there." Amelia said, "Bucky, I'd like to have your car to be my official car so that your car can really be in on the celebration in Washington," which was a darling of her. But she did things like that all the time. I just saw a man, Coffin, who was the first flyer for Curtis Wright. These are all my wonderful crew I had there, 28 boys in the flying fish coats. Now, Amblin, look at how she turned. She was a lovely vehicle. That's Starling Bridges at the microphone there with the mayor of Bridgeport and man named Scotty, that mechanic. The locomobile company had a little kind of a small raceway there, and we were running up and down, and the people came from all over the countryside to see that. At the Chicago World's Fair, another session, that next year, with my car, that's Frank Coffin, I said, the first flyer for Curtis Wright. The first man flew under Brooklyn Bridge. You see that canvas top, which I'm sorry to say, the button-down canvas top where the driver got killed. You can also see my window of my telescope there. But she was really superbly turned out. Starling Bridges building boats for the richest, most powerful yachtsmen in the world. Starling just said, "You never turn out half finished work. It really has to be really beautiful. If you have a principle to demonstrate, don't let it suffer because you haven't turned it out right." I was somewhat of a fatty then. I hadn't eaten for years, and suddenly I had enough money while I was building this thing. I was staying at a boarding house in Connecticut there, and they had cake and everything. I really just ate it. Been starving for so long. They got to Chicago World's Fair, and are we still on? We went to Chicago World's Fair the second year. I was invited out again, and they had my car do several things. Used to have it doing waltzing down in the main. It could waltz. It really could dance very beautifully. And then twice a day they wanted me to run it completely through the fairgrounds as a feature. And then I would end up at what's called the Wings of a Century. And the Wings of a Century was an enormous pageant because Chicago was a great railroad center. So they had all the great locomotives of the early history, from the earliest locomotives on. They had the great railroad yards, and they ran railroad cars and everything out on front of the grandstand of the Wings of a Century. The final episode of the show had the Maxim car after they had all the 20th century and all the fast trains and so forth. And I would come in from the wing. It was quite an open space. I suppose I'd have a length of a football field to get accelerated. So I really could come in very fast and go to the middle of the stage in front of the grandstand. And I would slow to my 15 miles an hour, put on my brakes and then throw in a complete ground loop. And everybody in the stand went up there, sure that I was going over, you see, and I see the thing spinning around. And I had the fundamental steering, so that once you let go of your wheel, she'd go absolutely in the direction at the time you let go. So that I I'm sitting on the seat, all right, and they had a place they wanted me to take position in the backstage, up the stage where all these vehicles were all around. And so I'd just be spinning around, and then she'd go right up to it, very lovely. But she redeemed herself very much in that second year, and that again brought Henry Ford's great interest, and he did all kinds of things to help me, incidentally, during it. He telephoned to me at Bridgeport when he heard I was doing what I was doing, and he gave me 70% discount on anything that Ford Motor Company made that I could possibly use. So I bought Ford engines and so things like that, of course. And I used this was the year of the first Ford V8. So I had this first Ford V8, and I put aluminum heads on it and things like that, and cut down increased the compression just a little bit. But I did get up to 128 miles an hour, and it all do this wonderful streamlining. Many times we would go out with another car of the same weight. We had to be a pretty good size Cadillac or Packard. We'd get them absolutely weighing exactly the same. And we'd get out on a main highway, a good, very flat highway on a still wind early morning, and we'd accelerate up to 60, and I'd have somebody sitting in both cars beside the driver, and he would shut off the engine. And we'd throw out the clutch instantly, and then let them see how far they go. The wind resistance of my car was so low that I really went, something fantastic, maybe half a mile further than the other car. It really started up really fast. It was incredibly low speed. I can't really tell you but it was a very great large differential. She was fared completely underneath the belly, absolutely fared all the way. Not just a mouse track with open down the butt. Our peasant cars are very, very resistive underneath, but not this car. Well, all I can tell you is that I'm... Here's my car at Wichita, Kansas, a number of years later, and to the left is my CB. That was my plane. I was surprised how much resemblance there really was between this and the airplane. That's a picture that Whitlow talks to you about, Ed, quite often. Now, what has happened since is that we did get into the flying bedstead. We did get into the Starling business used to say, Bucky, I think your principle would work for just a little altitude above water. That's the most you could possibly do. He did think that they might be able to get enough altitude, but he didn't think he could fly any height. But since that time, we now have the United States Marines using the JATO. We have to go to JATO, and these are really rocket. You get a real explosion. When you take a plane, then when they've had trouble getting off, they put these JATO assists, the little rockets on the wings, and really gets enormous acceleration to get off of the polar areas and things like that. Well, now they've got a tiny little pod. They began to put onto helicopters. They're helicopters where they have a road where the wing itself drives itself around. And they began putting JATO assists on those. And then I saw tiny little ram jets, just like a fountain pen put on there. JATO assists and then the ram jet. Two put on the end of it. And a helicopter, a Marine Corps helicopter, is like going really fantastically vertical, take off. So then we got where the Marines were beginning then to have this little apparatus where in their two hands they have these JATOs and they're jumping over the barn. Have you seen them doing this? Yeah, well, the point is they have a lot of trouble when they're trying to make, the Marine really tried to make my vehicle, and they did not have the center. The convergence of these vectors above the center of gravity come down here, and they got some rolling over. The pistols work, I assure you. And really, I'm quite confident what I've talked to you about. You will see this vehicle in due course. And we're getting to the point where it is now really practical to have a harness. You put this harness on, and you can have your jet stills. And you can go to the window and you can dial yourself with programming now of the directional controls and so on, so just go to the window and then go home. Put on the right clothes. But humanity is going to do these kind of things, and humanity is going to be doing the ultra-high frequency telepathy. These are the things that are going to be the surprise items that are not in the package that human beings tell to be dealing in now. But I've lived through enough of these things to really feel great confidence to tell you that's really whatever you really can do, you're going to have to do, and you will do.